Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Five, four, three.
She's pure alligator, pure white.
Two.
Albinos that do make it to reproductive age can't find a mate because they look funny.
One.
Albino affairs.
A fashion faux pas could be the worst consequence if you wear the wrong color for the season. But a new scientific paper finds much higher stakes when it comes to mismatched coat colors in the animal world. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports on researchers who are studying snowshoe hares in the Northwest against the backdrop of climate change.
Professor Scott Mills compares snowshoe hares to the ice cream cone of the forest.
My carnivorous graduate student likes to call them the cheeseburgers of the forest, meaning that they're eaten by pretty much every predator out there.
Mills says camouflage is the hare's most important survival tool. The typical wild hare sheds its brown coat and changes to white in winter to blend in with the snow. Now remember, though, warm winters like we had last year, how that could be a harbinger of the future under climate change. Mills and his team from the University of Montana and North Carolina State wondered about the snowshoe hares running around in white against brown backdrops. The research team tracked nearly 200 snowshoe hares in Montana with radio collars over 3 years.
We find that the cost of being mismatched is substantial. Every week that a hare is mismatched, it has a 7% lower chance of surviving than a hare that's not mismatched.
Mills says if there's any hopeful news here, it's that hares display wide variation in the timing of their coat color molt. So the next question is whether through natural selection and evolution, the animals can adjust to decreasing winter. Case in point, hares on Washington's Olympic Peninsula and along the Oregon coast have evolved to stay brown all winter. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Becky Lynn reported or had on her newscast earlier. Something happened here in the Valley today that has gone viral and is not good, and it does not represent the Valley, that's for sure. There was a photo opportunity, if you will, some senior pictures for Desert Vista High School, and the seniors all got together and had black shirts with letters on the shirts, and they were going to spell out, "Best you've ever seen, class of 2016. I guess, and Becky Lynn, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm assuming that after that picture was taken, best you've ever seen, class of 2016, I guess it was after that that some girls got together for a posed picture, and there was someone took a picture, put it on Instagram, and it has now gone viral of the N-word.
Yeah, made a new word out of the letters that were supposed to spell out something else.
Right. Six seniors, six girls, and they're all white. They wore black T-shirts, and they had a letter on each shirt, and it spelled out the N-word.
Nigga!
Now, the two G's that go in that word.
That word, yeah.
Instead of two G's, there were
asterisks.
So yeah. You had one girl wearing an N, one girl wearing an I, two girls wearing an asterisk. Keep going. One girl wearing an E, another girl wearing an R, and
they are posing, and they are smiling, and they are looking right toward the camera. This is not some fluky thing where everybody's walking together and people aren't, you know, one person's behind the other. And if you just line it up with your eye and just take a picture in that moment, no. This looks planned. This looks like the girls knew what they were doing, and they knew that it was a photo, and they probably said, this is funny, let's post it on Instagram. And nobody out of the seven people, because the person taking the picture didn't say this either, wait a minute, this might not be a good idea.
A lot of media, including KTAR.com, we blurred out the kids' pictures. Sorry, I wouldn't. I would leave the girls' faces up there. There are consequences in this world. And you know, they're high school kids. I was a dumb high school kid. Certainly what they did was really, really dumb. I would leave their faces up there. I would. And I know it sounds, you know, I know some of your parents say, oh, if that was my kid, gosh, I would kill him. Or, oh, my gosh, they'd never go to prom. They wouldn't get out of the house. But at least they would blur out their faces. No. Leave their picture up. Leave their faces up. If these six girls think it's funny to wear T-shirts that spell out the N-word and are dumb enough to smile, especially one of them with a big cheesy smile, if you think that's okay, well, you know what? Let's go down the road of, you did it, now you're going to pay for it, and everybody should see your face.
There are people all over the country, not just here in the Valley, people all over the country, including other black students, black leaders, that are saying these girls need to be expelled, these girls need to be dealt with severely. Tempe Unified School District said that they will be disciplined in accordance with district policy. That I would like to know what that is, because I can't imagine somebody coming up with a scenario of, what if a kid decides to take a picture of them all in a row with the N-word? Let's put that in the handbook. I don't know what's going to happen to them.
I had a question about why they were blurring the faces, because the girls already posted it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't blur their own faces.
Maybe they're not 18.
So they, well, that's a possibility. But they've already put it out there. It's already out there all over social media. So
I know.
I'm not clear on that.
I don't understand how someone can know the word, know what it means, and
do they understand we understand what that word means, what it implies, what its history is?
You can't tell me they think that's a funny word.
I you're right. I don't think it's a funny word, but I think
you don't.
Right.
But
right.
Really, do they feel that? Oh, that's a funny word. Let's do it. Let's put it. I don't buy that.
I think it's more of a, Let's see what we can get away with. We know it's a bad word, but we may hear it a lot. We hear it in songs. We hear other students maybe using it and referring to other students as that. I think it was one of those things where, this is something we shouldn't be doing, but we'll do it anyway. I bet you they don't understand. I don't know any 17-year-old that understands what the World Wide Web truly means. Until now, when it is all over the place, including all over the world, and now people from other countries are responding to these girls, I can't imagine they understood what the World Wide Internet meant until now.
See, I think the World Wide Internet, the web, Instagram that they use, I think that's part of the problem. But for me, it's a smaller part of the problem. The bigger problem is what would make six girls think taking a picture with black T-shirts that spell out the N-word is funny, is photographable, is something to post. What goes through your mind? I mean, do you look at all of the kids who had a letter on their black shirt
on the shirt?
Gee,
itself.
I wonder if we can all spell out the N-word, and if so, why don't we just take a picture? Because that's how it had to go down.
Okay,
right?
so if you're a parent, what? I don't even know what, because I totally hear what you're saying. I totally get what you're saying. What do you expect the kid to say? Like, what went through your mind? Do you think this is acceptable? Because all I can think of is the kid's like, yeah, we knew it was wrong, but we thought it was funny. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of, that there's just some things that kids think are, in the moment, are funny, yet they don't understand the implication moving forward. I don't know what acceptable explanation I would take as a parent.
Then these six kids need to be sat down and have an explanation of why that word shouldn't be used by
anybody.
Well,
their senior year's done. I mean, their senior year, yeah. And maybe their college career. See, that's the other thing, too, and we talk about this. I know we sound like old men. But we talk about this to interns. We will actually have the Instagram, Twitter. You cannot put stuff on here because you know, or no, they don't know. I should take that back. You cannot put stuff on this that will cause you to not get into a job, that will cause you to get fired. High schoolers need to have that talk now, too. They need to go into a counselor's office, and I guess counselors need to say, let me look at your Twitter account, and if there's bad words and, you know, other stuff that you shouldn't say in open public, you got to take it down.
I agree with you, but I'm less worried about them posting this. I'm more worried about the thought process that went into taking
a
picture.
Yeah, you also have to figure out, do you know and understand what that word
means?
That's
the core of the problem. And I think that we should all take this story, and if you have not talked about your child, white, black, Hispanic, it doesn't matter. If you have not talked about your child regarding the N-word, you need to. Because it seems...
You need to put it on the table. Don't wait for this to happen.
Yes. It seems that this generation, with social media, we are seeing it more. We saw it at ASU, the black MLK Black Party. Awful.
Yeah.
We saw another ASU kid last year towards the end of the year. Oh, I'm out cotton picking. I'm trying to get my inner end going. And she tweeted it.
Yeah.
And we're seeing Oklahoma with the frat boys last year.
Yeah, see,
chanting the N-word.
See, that bothers me because they're in their teens and in their, you know, I remember I said a bad word in front of my mom. I didn't know what it meant. I was in third grade.
Innocent.
And,
that's innocent.
And there wasn't social media. Somebody filming, you know, recording me and you know, putting it up on the World Wide Web. If you haven't had that talk, you got to have that talk because you can't wait. I mean, I can't imagine when these parents come home tonight, they are going to be barraged.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. If this was your neighbor, what do you say? I mean, what do you do?
This is your kid. You're just horrified.
I know. What do you say to him?
Ladies and gentlemen, today's feature presentation, Driving Miss Daisy.
No, man. No.
Just what I'm talking about. It's turned to the dim shit. I'm out of here, man. Hey, yo, check it out, man. I got Black Seas at the crib, man. Y'all want to go check that out?
Yeah.
It's the idea. We could have rolled it from the beginning. Y'all with it,
man. Fuck Hollywood, man.
Still to come, in the city of Flint, Michigan, there is poison on tap. The hometown of director Michael Moore was once an auto industry boom town, but it's fallen on hard times. Predominantly poor, it is predominantly black, and some say that is why its drinking water crisis has been allowed to fester for more than a year now. We'll talk about Flint, Michigan and its water woes in about a half hour from now, but first to the red carpet. It's full of white faces.
Welcome to the 87th Oscars. Tonight we honor Hollywood's best and whitest, sorry, brightest.
That was Neil Patrick Harris hosting last year's Academy Awards and doing his best to make a joke about something that's harder and harder to see as a laughing matter. The hashtag OscarsSoWhite was created last year by activist and writer April Rain to help call attention to the lack of diversity in the field of Oscar-nominated actors and movies. What a difference a year makes, or hasn't made. 20 out of 20 of this year's acting nominees are people who are white. And that has led to calls for an Oscars boycott. Prominent black stars, including Oscar winner Spike Lee, actor Jada Pinkett Smith, say they won't attend this year's gala. The latter's husband, Will Smith, joined with them yesterday. Okay, well, we are aiming to keep the conversation about on-screen diversity going here on our program today. Why it matters at the Oscars, why it matters in Hollywood, and why it matters in Canadian entertainment as well. We have three film and media insiders here with me in Toronto. Cameron Bailey is artistic director of TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival. Rocky Muta is the director and producer of the web series Anarchalee and CEO of Miss Muta Productions. And Amanda Paris is a writer and actor and the host of CBC's Exhibition. Hi.
Hello.
Kurt, not so white today. Not around this table. Okay, let's get into this. This has been, you know, the talk of everything for the last week. And there are really substantive things to dig into. But let's just start sort of at the surface with you, Cameron. What do you make about, you know, what's with the traction this week? Why is this getting so much attention? Because some people are saying, you know what? There's real issues to focus on. Oscar, so white.
I mean, I think the first thing is it's a sequel. This is the second year that this has happened, and I think people are paying a lot more attention this year. Last year, it was could have been written off as an anomaly. It's not an anomaly. And I think also you've got I think people just are fed up now, right? There is a groundswell of reaction to this. People are realizing that this is not good enough. It's not really just the Academy's fault, of course. The president's Cheryl Boone Isaacs has done a lot, along with the CEO, Don Hudson, to try to diversify their staff, to try to diversify their membership. They invited more members last year, a much more diverse list than exists. But has existed before, but the fact is that it's still dominated by older white men, and we have to think and we have to talk about how we make those decisions about what quality is, what prestige is.
We're going to talk about that. And, you know, everyone's saying, like, this is the second year in a row. Let's just, you know, call a spade a spade. This has historically been a problem.
Sure.
Like, we had the bump, you know, the difference was a couple years ago when we had a bunch of people nominated, not even a bunch, but some. Amanda Paris, so, you know, just take us through, like, because there is this argument out there that there just weren't enough films with black people in them. Who should have been nominated?
Well, I think that argument might serve people in some years, but not this year. There are so many quality films that were made. Creed, which was my personal favorite of last year, which also had like a 94% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. So it was actually critically acclaimed and really celebrated. And
this is the Rocky series.
Exactly. I think director Ryan Coogler deserved a nomination there. I think even the cinematographer, Maurice Alberti, who's a woman, also could have gotten a nomination there. Some people have said that Michael B. Jordan was worthy of a performance nomination. Girlhood, I think, was another really strong contender. Straight Outta Compton, another really strong contender. Tangerine is also another one. So those are all just in terms of movies. And then the performances within them are also worthy, and some of the directors as well, too. So, I mean, these names have been floating around for a little while all throughout the week. And there are some people that say, like in social media and stuff like that, say things like, oh, well, maybe there just wasn't anybody good enough this particular year. I think the fact that all of these movies had really high critical acclaim, I think the fact that for Straight Outta Compton and Creed, they were really popular in the box office. There's a lot of numbers that would disagree with that particular statement this year.
You know, it's interesting. I just caught myself saying, oh, Rocky, Sly Stallone, right? Like, I don't even know the name of the actor. Tell me again his name.
Michael B. Jordan.
Michael B. Jordan, right? He is the actor in that movie. I don't even know
his
name.
He's the lead.
Right?
It's the lead. Character
So that
story.
Says a lot about sort of like the systemic stuff that's sort of bubbling.
That's the heart
up,
of it. You know, what we watch when we watch movies.
Okay. Let me bring Rocky into the conversation. How much does it bother you that some of the people you're rooting for don't get an Oscar nod? Like, do you care?
Of course I care. I think it doesn't shock me. I think historically we've always seen this, so it wasn't a shock. But it's really bothersome, I think, as a young person growing up and you want to get into film, but you don't see people of color anywhere or being recognized or rewarded, makes you question whether this is an industry that you even want to move in.
You know, I'm going to, like, throughout our conversation put up sort of the criticism that I've heard this week or the backlash or things that people said, yeah, but what about this, right? So, Cameron, you know, some critics and lay people as well have argued that even if we look at the roles that black actors have won Oscars for, they're often ones that wouldn't have gone to non-black actors. So you think of Forrest Whitaker playing Idi Amin in The Last King of Scotland, 12 Years of Slave. Is there a type of role or film the Academy is willing to consider when they do recognize non-actors or filmmakers? Like, is it that role where it's a, well, could it only be played by a black actor?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for anybody else to go up for the role of Idi Amin besides a black actor.
I guess
that would
my
be
point.
A stretch.
Yes.
Maybe Robert Downey Jr. But yeah, I think that's part of it. Obviously, the Academy skews towards historical epics or historical stories in terms of what they give any awards to, but that's certainly the case with African-American characters. I think there's a discomfort among the industry generally with contemporary African-American lives and with contemporary diversity in America. America, of course, is a hugely diverse country, as is Canada. You see that much more on television. You see that in the music industry. You do not see it in movies, and you don't see it in prestige movies. There's a difference between box office and prestige movies.
So what's
movies.
The difference?
So Straight Outta Compton did really well at the box office, not considered prestigious enough for the Oscars. Star Wars had a white female and a black male lead, made $1 billion. It'll make a lot more. Again, no Oscars. So those are seen as entertainment, which is fine for the diverse population that America is. But when it comes to awards, different story.
You know, we always kind of pin this on America, right? It's not like just Americans are interested in the Oscars.
Oh, hell
I mean, this
no.
is the biggest.
No, it's here too.
Yeah, it's everywhere, right? All around the world.
I mean, for the longest time, people have been saying, well, I love Bernie, but of course he can't win.
That's right.
Now it looks like he can win, but his biggest problem is in the black community. So the brothers don't like him. Why?
Oh, no, that's not true.
Oh, it is.
I have 82%
of blacks.
Because we don't know Bernie. Once they get to know Bernie and recognize, it's true.
Okay.
Brother Bernie Sanders represents the politician. He's a grand exemplar of integrity in public life at the national level. He represents the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., Fannie Lou Hamer, and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, and Dorothy Day, and I would add John Coltrane, too.
Wow.
Because the Bernie Sanders campaign is a love train.
But you have to...
That's what it is.
And let's turn from the economy to politics and the challenge for Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. To win the Democratic presidential nomination, he'll have to do really well beyond the first votes in Iowa and New Hampshire. On March 1st comes Super Tuesday, when a dozen, mostly southern states, will hold presidential primaries and caucuses. And in many of those states, African Americans are key voters. Sanders spent last night in Birmingham, Alabama, celebrating Martin Luther King Jr. Day. From member station WBHM, Gigi Duban reports.
Back in 1963, when he was a college student, Bernie Sanders attended the March on Washington. That left an impression on him, and in a way, he sees himself keeping the mission of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. alive.
We must fight to carry out his radical and bold vision for America.
At a rally in an arena in downtown Birmingham, Sanders said the country must confront what he called institutional racism.
To create a country which provides economic, social, and environmental justice for all.
At the end of his speech, he spoke out against police brutality, calling for an end to, quote, militarized police. And if this was meant to appeal to African-American voters in Alabama, there was just one problem. In an audience of thousands, there were relatively few African-Americans there. Just before the rally, I caught up with Margaret Kidd of nearby Shelby County. She's 64, and this is her first political rally. She might not have been there if not for the fact that her son is heading the Sanders campaign in Alabama.
And he is really spreading the news in the African-American community. So we are here to see for ourselves what Bernie Sanders is really all about.
She says as candidates go, she knows Hillary Clinton better, but that's mostly because of Bill Clinton. Kidd says hardly anyone in her neighborhood or at her church knows about Sanders.
Vermont, those cold states up there, we don't know very much about down here in the nice warm South.
Christina Wilson is a freshman at Alabama State University, a historically black college. She came to the rally on a charter bus with about 30 other students. What does she know about Sanders?
Honestly, I don't know much. That's one of the main reasons why I'm here, because I don't know much.
At least some African Americans at the rally knew about Sanders. John Roberts, a college student in Birmingham, has been following him for a while. Roberts is pretty sure Sanders' plain-spoken style can win support in the African American community over time. So where were most of the African-Americans?
I don't have no idea, but I'm here.
And for now, that was good enough. For NPR News, I'm Gigi Duban in Birmingham.
This is Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. This past weekend, the San Francisco Bay Area saw a number of protests meant to denounce police killings, racial inequality, and to reclaim the radical tradition of Martin Luther King Jr. The protests culminated in a rally and march in Oakland in which more than 1,000 people attended. A group of activists then drove on to the iconic San Francisco Bay Bridge. Later, they stopped their cars, they got out, and they stopped traffic for some 90 minutes. We now bring you sounds from the rally. The voice you'll hear is that of one of the organizers, Kat Brooks, and then we'll hear a live report from the bridge that Davey D, my colleague, provided for his radio program, Hard Knock Radio. That will come after these voices from the rally.
And all of those things that are happening in our cities are the very antithesis of what Dr. King stood for. Over the years, they managed to sanitize his image. All we hear about is the I Have a Dream speech, the Love Your Brother speech. But they don't want to talk about the king who was connecting the dots between race and class. They don't want to talk about the king that was condemning U.S. imperialism at home and comparing it to U.S. oppression here. We're also utilizing this weekend to hold up the hypocrisy of those people who would say that Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycotts were a good thing for America, but that shutting down BART stations and demanding that the war on black lives come to an end is a bad thing. You can't do this and then condemn that. You can't uphold Rosa Parks and denounce Alicia Garza. It don't work that way.
In the case that you stand for, we're fired up, won't take it no more.
Okay, I'm right here about on the halfway stand to the Bay Bridge, and it looks like there were a number of people that have chained themselves to near the entrance to Treasure Island. I didn't get a chance to go up there real close, but I got a gentleman here that was before the police started ordering people back into their cars. What's your name, man?
My name is Dominic Water.
Dominique, now we've seen you around before. What did you see when you went up close to where the police are at?
Man, well, me and Quentin here, man, trying to rob us some fast food. You know, we out here representing. We just come from the Martin Luther King Day March in the Frisco. And we just seen people get out their car, so we went to go check it out. And it was beautiful, man. It was a bunch of young African individuals that's from these states, man, linked together in solidarity with cars kind of blocking off the sections. And they had their arms chained through the windows to the east side of the bridge, man. It was beautiful. It was so powerful. I wish anybody just could have been there to see it.
How did they have themselves chained? They were doing it through the car windows, you said?
Through the car windows, chained wrapped around their waist, through their arms, and they were locked in, and they weren't going anywhere. They were demanding justice for all these murders that's been taking place in the Bay Area, and I was just proud to see it.
Dominique, I appreciate it. Sis, what, you have anything you want to say? What did you say?
I see nothing but solidarity. My name is Shonda Roberts. I represent low-paid workers, fashion workers, and this is what we need. We need the people to stand up and amplify our voices so we can have social justice in the society, broken society that we live in nowadays. And this is something that our ancestors have been fighting for. They paved the way for us to do this. And so it's our time to set an example for our ancestors, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. We need to represent for them.
Some people might say that backing up traffic is the wrong message, that it inconveniences people and that folks have things to do. What do you say to people that are concerned that maybe this type of protest sends the wrong message?
Well, I think this sends the right message, that solidarity is the new I love you. It's coming together to make that change, to voice our voices. You know, this is the only way it's going to happen. We have to take drastic measures. And unfortunately, we have to take drastic measures in order for our society to see that Black Lives Matter. And that's what it's about. Black Lives Matter.
We appreciate that. For people who don't know, I'm down here, and the attitude on the bridge is actually when it's kind of festive. I said this earlier, people are taking pictures, people are talking with one another. It is not a one of hostility. It may be that way further back, but at least in this part of the stand, people have been taking pictures, holding everybody's cell phone, posing, primarily because if for any reason, whether people agree with the message or the protest or whatever, you're just on this Bay Bridge and people have been able to take these iconic shots that they haven't been able to do. And that's what's happening here. And so, I'm here. I don't know how long we're going to be here. The police, as I said, did order people that moved to the front of the line where the protesters are. They threatened them with arrest if they did not get back into their vehicles. So we've been, I moved further back to where I'm at, where my car is at. And that's what's going on right now here on the Bay Bridge.
Again, a live report from my colleague, Davey D. If you want to hear more of the interviews that he did from the San Francisco Bay Bridge yesterday, you can do so by listening to Heart Knock Radio later in the day.
This the city of Chicago.
Chicago. Go to Chicago, where a deeper pattern of police brutality is emerging as yet another video of a police shooting surfaces. An order by a federal judge this week allowed for the release of that police shooting of a white officer. Black teenager shot while he was running away on foot. 17-year-old Cedric Chapman was thought to have been involved in a carjacking in January of 2013. Police pursued him, ultimately killed him. Police had accused Chapman of turning and pointing an object at police as he ran, but it turned out Chapman was unarmed. What was he pointing at police? A black iPhone. Richard Boykin is Cook County Commissioner in Chicago. He joins me from WBEZ. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think this 2013 video says about a pattern of brutality that is way beyond a single incident here?
Look, I think it says that there is a culture of cover-up. There is a culture of protecting wrongdoers within the police department. This incident with Cedric Chapman is something that is unconscionable. Obviously, that on the heels of the release of the video with Laquan McDonald being shown walking away with a knife in his hand, not a threat to the officers on the scene. Let me be clear that there are good police within the police department. However, these incidences of police misconduct, they continue to be seen throughout the city of Chicago. Now, look, one of the things that's troubling for many of us is that there was an indictment in the Laquan McDonald case of Officer Van Dyke just hours before the release of the video. The prosecutor waited 400 days to make an indictment. We do not believe that she would have indicted that police officer if, in fact, the video would not have been ordered released by the judge. The other thing that's troubling in that case is that there were officers on the scene, about 7 or 8 officers. These officers filed false police reports to corroborate the account of Van Dyke, Officer Van Dyke. These officers have not been charged, have not been disciplined, and are still being paid and working.
It's legal to file a false police report in the city of Chicago or anywhere?
Look, it appears that that is the norm because the prosecutor has not indicted these officers for filing false police reports, nor have these officers been disciplined. I asked the question a few days ago in a committee hearing of the chief of staff to the state's attorney, Anita Alvarez. Have these officers been indicted or have these officers been disciplined? His response was the investigation is ongoing. None of us can understand. This has been 14 months. We all saw the video. I could deduce in 13 seconds that this was a murder in the Laquan McDonald case. This officer shot him in the back and shot him 16 times. This is wrong. We wouldn't treat an animal this way. And so why would we allow for officers to treat a human being this way?
Let's focus on the Chapman video for just a moment. It seems to me that, it's a distant shot of the victim. And I don't know. It's really very difficult to understand what's going on there. It's almost as though the cops just didn't have the energy to go after him. He was thought to be involved in a carjacking and just decided to bring him down just because that was easier. That's cold to say, but you just can't interpret it any other way.
Look, from the video, that's what it appears to be, and that should never happen. Look, the culture is set by the superintendent of police. Obviously, this superintendent, Gary McCarthy, is gone now. But the mayor ultimately selects the police chief or the police superintendent. We must send a signal through the Chicago Police Department that this type of behavior will not be tolerated. Now, the mayor, to his credit, has made some positive steps of reform. And these positive steps came as a result of the shooting of Quintonio LeGreer and Betty Jones, an innocent person who was just there on the scene. This shooting happened on the 26th of December. Of course, it was a shooting where the individual, Quintonio LeGreer, was having a mental health episode. He had a baseball bat in his hand. The officer, shot him 7 times and mistakenly shot or accidentally shot Betty Jones in the process. The mayor has ordered crisis intervention training for all police, and he's ordered tasers to be available in police units, in all police units. And so I think that those are necessary things that will help, hopefully, to save lives. But the other thing that the mayor should say is that individuals should not be shot in the back. If someone's fleeing a scene, look, from a carjacking, does the guy deserve to die? I don't think so. Let him flee the scene. Catch up with him another day.
Finally, you mentioned a message needs to be sent. You talked about some reform measures that the mayor seems to be endorsing. But what firing or disciplinary action would be necessary to deliver that message, even to prosecutors and the court system, that this is just not going to be tolerated by the people of Chicago?
Look, so one of the things that we did in the Cook County Board, and I'm so proud of my colleagues, is that we passed a resolution calling for the appointment of a special prosecutor in the Laquan McDonald case, as there is a crisis of confidence right now as to whether or not the state's attorney can actually appropriately prosecute this case. Now, we believe, like in New York, where Governor Cuomo has actually issued an executive order, in all police-involved shootings of unarmed civilians, the appointment of a special prosecutor is automatically triggered. So we passed the first step of that. We're also trying to pass the second step of it. Right now, Governor Rauner in Illinois does not have the same kind of authority to issue an executive order to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to ask the legislature to give him that authority so that there is no question that justice and fairness will be done in police-involved shootings, and that this cozy relationship between prosecutors and police won't impede the justice system from flowing and the fact that individuals can get justice.
Richard Boykin is a Cook County Commissioner in Chicago. He spoke to us from WBEZ in that city. Commissioner, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
I want to be a cop.
Fox Lake Police Lieutenant who staged his suicide is back in the news. A lawsuit accusing Lieutenant Joe Glinowitz of harassment is about to get its first day in court. Eyewitness News reporter Tanya Babbage is live at the Dirksen Federal Building with more. Tanya.
Terrell, the plaintiff in this case, or attorneys for the plaintiff, say that he was actually hospitalized for anxiety after the harassment and the intimidation that he suffered at the hands of Fox Lake officers, specifically Lieutenant Joe Glinowitz. This man is 26-year-old Vernon Randolph. He lives in North Chicago but visits Fox Lake all the time to see his daughter. He says Lieutenant Joe Glinowitz pulled him over about a year before the officer's death. Glinowitz searched Randolph's car and demanded to know where the drugs were. Well, Randolph says he didn't have any and that he was stopped repeatedly from that day forward. Lawyers say Glinowitz followed Randolph around, pointing to his eyes as if to say, "I'm watching you." Then on September 1st, Glinowitz radioed into the department claiming he was following three suspicious men, one black and two white. Now, Randolph would often be seen with two white men waiting at the bus stop where their children would get picked up. That was one of the locations where he says Glinowitz used to track him down. When Glinowitz was found shot to death, the feds came knocking on Randolph's door.
It's the devil. Really? He was one dirty guy. Mainly, I just want to feel safe again.
Lawyers say authorities obtained DNA swabs from Randolph, who was cleared of any wrongdoing when the medical examiner ruled the officer's death was a suicide. Still in a town where black men make up less than 1% of residents, Randolph said he had a target on his back. Again, this case being heard in court for the first time today. Live outside the federal courthouse, Tanya Babbage.
When you're a cop, you can torment freely and see me valley, then season outy, then beam proudly. Turn a routine traffic stop to your season finale when you're a cop.
Request for a mistrial denied. Tonight, a former Oklahoma City police officer is locked up in jail, where he will remain for the rest of his life.
The defendant is guilty of the crime. Guilty, guilty, guilty.
Convicted of 18 sexual assault crimes against women.
I can rest knowing he is in prison, which allows me of being able to live my life.
And we begin tonight at 10 with closure to an Oklahoma case that gained national attention.
Daniel Holtzclaw sentenced to 263 years in prison.
News Channel 4's Leslie Rangel joins us live outside the Oklahoma County Jail.
And less things were put on hold in the courtroom today after an attempt by Holtzclaw's attorneys to halt the sentencing.
That's right, Kevin. After a three-hour delay because of Holtzclaw's attorneys that had asked for a new trial. Now, in the end, that request was denied. And he sits inside the Oklahoma County Jail waiting to be transported to prison. No expression on Daniel Holtzclaw's face after a judge handed down a sentence of 263 years, a victory for victims.
I see freedom.
Justice was served today. I just know how glad I am and how proud I am, especially for all the victims, how we were traumatized and all the things we had to go to.
I am loved.
Thank God for those who do believe us. And no matter how powerful he was and how vulnerable and helpless we were, he had no power to do what was done to us.
The district attorney assuring women Holtzclaw would not do this again.
Men who victimize women, this is what's going to happen to you. We will lock you up. This is about the victimization of women, no matter what color, and that predators are out there, not just going after compromised African-American women, but also compromised Native American women, Hispanic women, Asian women, and white women.
But for many, this case was about race.
A police officer has gone to prison for life for something done to black women.
A message for black women and black girls that you can come forward, state your case, and get justice.
Today is the day of accountability.
A man the courts say abused his power as an Oklahoma City police officer to prey on women. He'll now spend the rest of his remaining days in jail.
What a day of victory!
Yes.
Now, Holtzclaw's attorneys say they do plan on filing an appeal. And, of course, we'll keep you updated as more information becomes available. Reporting live at the Oklahoma County Courthouse, Leslie Rangel, News Channel 4.
Say, brother, can I get some of that water, man? Just a little bit, you know, maybe like a drop or two. You got all the water in the world, brother. Just let me get a little bit, please. That's all I can get. I mean, I see you over there shining with all that water, man. I just need a little bit. I mean, it's hard out here.
For more on the water crisis in Flint, I'm joined now by the city's mayor, Karen Weaver. She took office last November after campaigning on fixing the city's water problems. While she's in Washington for a meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, she has stopped by our studios. Mayor Weaver, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You met with President Obama this week, as well as some of his senior advisors. What did you take away from that meeting?
Well, it was a very positive meeting. I was glad to have the president hear firsthand from me what's been going on in the city of Flint for almost 2 years at this point. People have been crying and begging and asking for clean water. The other thing we talked about is the support that we need to get. And while he has pledged to do everything that he can at the federal level and has in fact sent people to Flint to get started on this, one of the things he stressed is that he was going to be meeting with the governor the very next day because the state has such a big role to play in this, and we know the state has money. They have a rainy day fund, a surplus of between $500 and $600 million, and Flint needs to be the priority for receiving those funds.
And as we heard, the governor released about 200 pages of emails yesterday. What, if anything, struck you about those messages?
Well, you know, I haven't seen what's in those emails, but I will tell you this. It's something that he needed to do because one of the issues we've been dealing with has been broken trust, and we have been kept in the dark about some information regarding our water. We've been given misinformation about the water, and the only way that the governor can, if he can, rebuild trust is to start doing that. So it's a start for him, I suppose.
I want to read to you from one of the emails, which was from the governor's chief of staff to the governor and others, and this was from late September. And the chief of staff, Dennis Muchmore, writes, "The DEQ and the DCH, that's the Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Community Health, he says, the DEQ and DCH feel that some in Flint are taking the very sensitive issue of children's exposure to lead and trying to turn it into a political football." He wrote that in September. How do you react?
Muchmore wrote that? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's been the problem. This has been politics and profit over the lives of people. The health of the people was not put before profit and money. And that's part of the reason we find ourselves in this situation, because the other thing I have to bring up is we haven't had a voice in a long, long time in the city of Flint because we've been under emergency manager. But people have been speaking up and crying about this for a long time. So to hear that, it just verifies what we talked about. It was profit over the people.
Do you feel like you have a voice now?
Yes.
You're getting shipments of drinking water. You're getting millions of dollars in federal funds. What do you need most at this point?
You know what? We need to start addressing some of the other issues now, because we need the water. We need the filters. But that's a Band-Aid. But it's a Band-Aid that we're going to continue to need. But the other thing we need to do is start looking at the infrastructure. Even though we've switched back to Lake Huron water through Detroit, those lead service lines are the issue. And how long are we supposed to wait for biofilm to build back up? No one can tell us how long that will take. And we need to be able to drink our water.
No one can tell you how long that will take, meaning you don't know when the city's water will be safe to drink again?
Exactly. And that's why it's still a crisis, because we don't know when we'll be able to drink the water.
A lot of very high-profile figures have called on Governor Snyder to resign. What's your position on this?
You know what? I'm glad those high-profile figures are out there, and they're putting the pressure on the governor and holding him accountable for some things. What I've said is we have an investigation going on, and I can't wait to hear the results of that investigation, because everybody that should be held accountable needs to be held accountable. We want to know who knew what and when they knew it. And that's from the governor all the way down to if it includes local officials. We want everyone to be held accountable, and if it means they have to be removed, so be it.
Flint is a majority black city.
Correct.
Where more than 40% of people live below the poverty line.
Correct.
Many people have suggested that this would not have happened if it were in a wealthy white suburb of Detroit.
Yes.
How much do you believe race and poverty had to do with the response to this crisis?
I believe that had a lot to do with the response. It also has a lot to do with the emergency manager law that's been put in place, because that's where you see emergency managers going into cities that are predominantly minority African American and where they have high poverty levels. You know, I'm not the only person that believes that. That's why the local, state, and national NAACP have even stepped up and put out statements regarding this, because it's a civil right. Water is a basic human right, and it's being violated right now.
I want to ask you whether Flint can recover from this, but in this context, I don't even know, what does recovery mean for Flint?
You know
Flint?
What? It's a terrible thing. No community should ever have to go through what Flint has gone through, but I'm also looking at the possibility of what can come out of this. And I've always believed in Flint. I'm excited about the potential, and, you know, we've got to get this fixed. But there's a lot to look forward to in the city of Flint, and you're going to have me back, because I'm going to be telling the second part of this story.
The victory lap?
That's right.
When is that going to be?
Well, you know what? I can't tell you such and such a time, but we continue to keep getting things going our way. We're some very strong, resilient fighters in the city of Flint. So every day, more and more things continue to go our way.
Mayor Karen Weaver, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Karen Weaver, the mayor of Flint, Michigan. She joined us here in the studio while she's in town for a meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors.
Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
For nearly 25 years, Karen Brannon applied her journalistic skills to looking into the story of a lynching of four black citizens in 1912 in her family's hometown, Hamilton, Georgia, where her grandfather and great-grandfather had served as sheriffs. The result is her new book called The Family Tree, A Lynching in Georgia, A Legacy of Secrets and My Search for the Truth, in which she writes about learning about her own slave-owning ancestors, her racially mixed family, and her great-grandfather's role in allowing the lynching to take place. Ms. Brannon has written for newspapers, magazines, stage, and television for the past half century. Her book is published by Atria Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Karen Brannon to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You write that you began researching this book when you asked your grandmother, what's your most unforgettable memory? Were you surprised by the answer?
I certainly was. I was very surprised by the answer. She said the hanging, and she said it so quickly she didn't have to think about it. It was as if it were just sitting there waiting to come out. And this was in 1984, and I said, what hanging? And she said, well, there was a woman and some men who were hanged downtown in Hamilton. And I said, well, what in the world had they done? She said, well, they were moonshiners, and they had been in a moonshine war, and they had been found guilty, and so that was how they punished people back then. And at the time, I thought she was talking about completely about white people. So I didn't press her on anything, unfortunately. And by the time I finally began, decided this was a story I had to learn more about and perhaps tell to others, my grandmother was dead. So.
But you asked other people in the family, did any of them, were any of them forthcoming?
Oh, well, in the beginning, my mother, in fact, that very day, as I walked out of my grandmother's bedroom where I had been doing this oral history with her, my mother is sitting there eavesdropping, and she says, "You can't believe everything she says. She embroiders, you know."
Well, actually, she didn't embroider. She left a lot out. You write, "I had always sensed that a day would come when my career as a reporter and my complicated family history would collide in some crucial way." But were you prepared for what you finally discovered? Could you be?
No. No. Had I known what I was going into, Leonard, I think I would have run. I would have become a travel writer in the South Pacific.
Well, did you even know that your ancestors had been slave owners?
Yes.
On both sides?
I did not know on both sides. My mother's family was less well off. They were a family of sheriffs, but they never had much money or land. So she had always told me that they did not own slaves. My father's mother had actually bragged to my sister and I as children that his people, not her people, but his people were very, her husband's people, the Williamses of Harris County, were very large slave owners. So I did know about that. Yes.
And what happened after abolition?
Well, what happened after abolition?
Do they remain connected?
Yes. As far as I can tell, most of those freed people remained in Harris County and remained on the plantation. But the plantation was divided up. They were given, it wasn't divided up equally, of course. But many of the adult male slave freed people were given parcels of land, usually an acre, maybe 10 acres at most. Some of them actually were very enterprising, and some of their acreage grew very large throughout the 70s and 80s.
If they were allowed to even claim in yes. public that they owned that acreage.
Absolutely, and very rarely was it filed in the courthouse.
What is what you refer to as the lost cause?
Well, the lost cause was the myth that was constructed with great vigor by primarily wealthy former slave owners, and their wives played a huge role in that, their daughters as well. The beautiful South, the charming South, the gentle South, the South where... yes, there were slaves, but they were all happy, and everyone got along, and they lived. It was a Camelot, and this myth was propagated all over the country, and Northern writers bought into it and wrote novels.
The Civil War was not fought over slavery.
No.
It was fought over the Constitution, hearth and home.
Absolutely.
And we continue to hear that only recently when there was the discussion about whether the Confederate flag should be removed from state houses across the South.
Oh, yes. The lost cause is alive and well, and really now for the first time, I believe, is it being challenged widely by people in the South, and people in the North are challenging that, and especially African Americans are challenging that.
Did you grow up in Hamilton?
No, I grew up in Columbus, which is 20 miles south of Hamilton. I spent my summers in Hamilton, and we went to Hamilton after Sunday school and church every Sunday.
Were the two towns fairly similar?
Oh, no, they were very different. Columbus at the time was the second largest city in Georgia. It was a city with much more culture and industry. It was a textile city. So it was... probably about 100,000 people at the time when I was a child.
Second only to Atlanta.
Yes. Yes, second only to Atlanta. Hamilton was, I think, pretty much the same size it had always been at that time, which was about 900 people, 600 of them African-American and 300 of them European-American.
Your description of Hamilton in the years following the Civil War through the 1920s is frightening because of all the violence. How many of your family members were murdered throughout those years?
Well, it depends on how you count family members. If you count in-laws as well as blood kin, I would say at least 25.
Well, that's because your family, like many former slave-holding families is quite complicated. It feels as though you were related to nearly every person in town, both black and white. Did you always know that you came from a mixed-race family?
Heavens no. Heavens no. That was the great secret. I believe that up until my mother's generation, they knew these things. But whether they sat down at a conference and decided that this horrible secret would remain that for the rest of eternity, I don't know. But I certainly had never been given any indication of that.
So when did you learn that yours was a two-family family?
Well, I learned that this was what my mother called these families, where, as she put it, the white man had a black family and a white family. And everyone knew about it. And the children all looked the same, other than their skin color. She asked me not to tell her if I discovered that in our family. I'm quite sure that she knew, because it was actually on her side of my family that I first discovered it. I discovered it on both sides, actually. But in my mother's family, my mother's mother's mother was a Moor, and one of the four victims of the lynching in 1912 that I investigated was named Johnny Moore. And Johnny Moore was 21 years old. He was a widower. He was engaged. He was a farmer. And at first I didn't recognize, I didn't say, oh, this is a Moore. He must be kin to me. In fact, it never occurred to me that Johnny Moore might be kin to me. And I began to research, and by a very mysterious sequence of events, I came upon a certificate of indenture in the Harris County Courthouse, which talked about a great uncle of mine, James B. Moore, who was a pig farmer and the brother of the sheriff before the Civil War. James B. Moore had one slave, a woman named Jane, and Jane had seven children, all of which were mixed race. So he had indentured those children for their until they were 21 years old, right after in 1868. And he promised in the indenture to treat them as a father would. I began to do more research and to talk to people about this, and I discovered that, in fact, those seven children were the children of James B. Moore.
I'm speaking with Karen Brannan, B-R-A-N-A-N, whose work has appeared in Life, Mother Jones, Ms., PBS, CBS, BBC, CNN, among others, and she has written a new book called The Family Tree, A Lynching in Georgia, A Legacy of Secrets, and My Search for the Truth. So did the white women of Hamilton turn a blind eye to what the men were up to?
For the most part, I believe they did. I can't know what private conversations they had in their parlors after the children went to bed. I know that there were, I found some evidence that there were women who were beginning to speak out about this. There was a newsletter being created by a woman out who lived out near where the people who were lynched lived, out in a little town called Mountain Hill. She wrote a newsletter in which she, in a kind of veiled way, said, these white men have got to stop doing things that white women would never get away with doing.
Well, it wasn't just the sex. Yeah. Your great-granduncle, brother to your great-grandmother, shot their father in the head in front of her.
Oh, absolutely.
And she was the sheriff's wife?
The sheriff's wife was 10 years old, yes. My grandmother, my great-grandmother, Emma Hadley, was 10 years old when she witnessed her brother shoot her father in the head.
Well, that must have caused PTSD or something similar.
I think so. What I always heard about Emma was that she was a very frail woman psychologically.
And she wound up addicted to morphine.
She may have been addicted to morphine. She was not one of the ones that I mentioned. It was actually my grandmother who told me the story of the lynching, who was addicted to morphine. And I discovered that at least six other women, her friends, who were married to law enforcement people, were also addicted to morphine.
Now, you said that all of the lynchings were all tied to moonshine.
Yes.
How did these four innocent people wind up being lynched in the moonshine wars?
Well, it was really not their particular lynching. It was much more about misogyny, sex between white men and black women, than it was about moonshine. But the moonshine culture was alive and well in Harris County, and it was just as great an industry as agriculture was. So very, very many people were involved in moonshine. And these people may or may not have been. I think at one time they may have been. The one that was kin to me, Johnny Moore, was not involved in moonshine. He was just a straight-out up-and-up farmer. But it was the misogyny issue. They were suspected of murdering a white cousin, the nephew of the sheriff, a man by the name of Norman Hadley, who was a moonshiner. And Norman Hadley, as it turns out, was a rather notorious womanizer, and he preferred African-American women. So Norman Hadley was chasing a young black woman, a teenager really, a 14-year-old. And so the people that were suspected of murdering him were John Moore, who was engaged to this young woman, was a preacher who was preaching against Norman Hadley, was a farmer who was the father of this young woman, whose name was Bertha Hardaway. And the third person, the woman, was supposed to be the star witness who would testify against these three men.
She was the concubine to one of the leading citizens in town.
She was the concubine, I am told, to a cousin of mine on my father's side and one of the leading citizens of the county.
Now, there were lots of murders, as you said. Why did this murder become an international story?
That's a very good question. I think because, number one, she was the first woman to be lynched in Georgia. Her name was Dusky Crutchfield.
And she was lynched because she might say embarrassing things if there had been a trial?
She was supposed to be the witness. Something happened along the way that made the case fall apart. In fact, my great-grandfather, Sheriff Buddy Hadley, never had enough evidence to even bring charges. No charges were ever brought against them. She decided along the way, for some reason, if she ever did agree to testify, she decided not to testify.
Now, what you describe, the thing that leads up to the lynching is rather horrific and something that I'm not really ready to talk about during lunchtime. But was it as difficult for you to write about as it was for me to read?
Well, it took years. It took years for me to even start to write about this, Leonard, because I was traumatized by learning about it. And I don't hesitate to say it took some good therapy to get me to the point that I could write this story and that I could tell it.
Did any people in the white community come to the defense of these four people who are obviously innocent?
Not that I know of. If they did, it went unrecorded.
Well, what about your great-grandfather? It was his job to prevent
lynchings. It was my great-grandfather's job to prevent this. He did make an effort at one point. There was an attempted lynching on the day that he took them to the prison, to the jail. He talked the lynch mob down, saying, I'll get a special trial. I'll go down to Columbus. I'll get a special trial. Let's do it legally. Let's do it the right way. He did get the special trial, but he was unable to deliver the goods as far as the trial going through, that he simply did not have the evidence that he needed.
And to some degree, he would have been protecting one of his own relatives, wouldn't he?
He might have been protecting one of his own relatives.
which he would have disowned.
Yeah, oh, you're talking about the, yes, Johnny Moore. No. I don't know whether Buddy Hadley thought of Johnny Moore as one of his relatives. You know, I can't get into the heads of people back at that time and whether they went around saying, this black fellow is my cousin. I really don't know how he felt about that.
Why was the prospect of a trial for the four black citizens so threatening to the town? You're right. It's difficult for modern readers to understand just how fundamentally white supremacy was undermined by interracial sex.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful way to put it. And this was also a time in history that I had never known of, and it's been very little written about. It was a time in history when there was an open public discussion about sex between white men and black women. It was in newspapers. It was in magazines. In the North, they were magazines. Muckrakers were scandalizing the Southern whites for having these two-family families. The South was vehemently denying it. There was a governor who was going all over the state organizing these law and order committees to report white men who were having sex with black women, to report. They were having black men, asking black men to report white men. This was unheard of, and it was causing quite a lot of anxiety.
Did the lynchings continue past the 20s?
Yes. The last lynching in Georgia, and Georgia had more lynchings than any other state, was in 1946 in Walton County, Georgia. I believe that was the last one in Georgia, though, you know, I think there are probably lynchings, what's called private lynchings, that have not ever been reported to this day.
One woman, Miss Lula Mobley, played a role in stopping the lynchings.
Oh, yes. This was my happiest finding in the midst of so much negative knowledge that I was gaining about my family. I came upon Miss Lula. And the way I came upon Miss Lula was not from any of the white women in my family or even any of the white men in my family, but an African-American farmer who I ran across in his corn patch. And I walked up to him, and I just flat out asked him, did you ever hear about the lynching in 1912? And he starts talking like it was yesterday, and he's telling me some very frightening things. And then he stops, and a big grin appears on his face, and he says, but that all stopped. The ladies stopped it. And I said, what ladies? And he said, the ladies in Hamilton, the church ladies. Well, that had to be Miss Lula, because Miss Lula was the grand church lady of Hamilton.
You also discovered, while doing this research, that you had illustrious African-American relatives. For example, you learned that Anna Julia Cooper was a cousin to your Williams side,
yes,
of the family.
Yes.
She was a black feminist, co-founder of the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs, and also the writer of A Voice from the South.
Yes. Dr. Anna Julia Cooper. This was my other most happy moment when I discovered her, and that was such a strange thing because I had known about Dr. Cooper from my years teaching women's labor history at the University of Minnesota. And I had a quote from her in which she was excoriating white Southern men for taking advantage of young African-American girls and women. And I wanted to use this quote in my book, but I didn't. I was trying not to pull things in from outside the family and the town. So something said to me, check out Anna Julia Cooper and find out who she is. And in fact, she had herself written of who her white father was, a man by the name of George Washington Haywood, from a very prominent family in Raleigh. And I knew that the Haywards were cousins of ours. And I knew then that Anna Julia Cooper was a cousin of mine.
Just one more thing. You went back to Hamilton in researching this book. Has the town changed a lot? Do you still feel like you're in the Deep South?
Yes. Yes. Hamilton itself has stayed amazingly the same. Some things have changed, but a lot of things have not. Visually, it looks a lot like it did when I, you know, it's abandoned more. There's not as much life there. But one thing I have to tell you about that has changed in Hamilton, they are embracing this book. They are embracing this story. Now, that's not 100%, and I'm still waiting for that other shoe to fall. But on Friday night, my family and I in Hamilton at the United Methodist Church this coming Friday night are going to recognize the 104th anniversary of the lynching, January 22nd, at the White Methodist Church. And we are going to recognize these people whose lives were snuffed out brutally, in a most brutal fashion, who no one has ever bothered to talk about, no one ever bothered to find out who they were, what their lives were like. And I've done that not as well as I'd like to have, but to the best of my ability. It will be a biracial service, and it is being supported by a large number of people in Hamilton, Georgia.
Karen Brannon's book is The Family Tree, A Lynching in Georgia, A Legacy of Secrets in My Search for the Truth, published by Atria Books. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
And I hope you are again, staying warm, staying safe in the snow.
Dealing with the real white supremacy when the snow falls at this level. It brings the powers of mere human beings to shame.
Wow.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 23rd, 2016. So I have been told Dr. Welsing still with us and very current. Hope folks that are on the East Coast are staying warm, staying dry, stay inside, unless you absolutely have to be outside. I am no fan of the cold weather, so my thoughts and prayers are with you. It was about 50 degrees here in the Pacific Northwest today, and I complained about being cold all day, so I cannot imagine how grumpy and unpleasant I would be if I was out there with you all. But stay warm, and man, I hope it melts and you all are able to get back to being outside and normal soon. Compensatory call-in. Chime in if you have thoughts you would like to share. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We are fundraising for 2016. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. If you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not in the PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Right on. Folks in the Flint area, I know we've been talking about the Flint water situation, and that's got a lot more attention over the last 2 weeks or so, I feel like, even though this has been a problem for roughly 2 years, approximately. Some of our listeners that are in the Michigan area and people who just have information about what's happening in the Michigan area, they've asked if you would like to help, if you would like to support the folks that are down there or over there in the Michigan area. This is what you can do. You can send bottled water. You can send it, or you can order water bottles online and have them delivered to Triumph Church, and the address is 1657 Broadway Boulevard, Flint, Michigan, 48506. The church has distributed 36,000 water bottles so far. The address again is Triumph Church, 1657 Broadway Boulevard, Flint, Michigan, 48506. Address again, Triumph Church, 1657 Broadway Boulevard, Flint, Michigan, 48506. If you need more information, I'll post the information on my Facebook page so you can check it out. If you would like to do what you can to support, send water to the folks up there. Horrendous situation all the way around. Anywho, moving forward, quick notes that I wanted to make sure that I got in before we get to some of the folks who called in. Let's see. First up, the Oscar situation. I thought that was really one of the most trivial situations that got a lot of attention this week when you have people that don't have water, and that's not something that's exclusive to Flint, Michigan, but all the other problems that are going on worldwide with regards to racism, white supremacy, and to have people complaining or acting surprised about the Oscar situation, I thought it was revealing that nobody, or at least the reports that I saw, the report that I played that was from CBC, Bill Maher talked about this a lot on his program yesterday. They had NPR, I mean, everybody, it seemed, was talking about this. I didn't hear one person, I didn't read everything, but I didn't hear one person reference those Sony emails. Remember that? The end of, I think that was like the end of 2014 when everybody was talking about that. Amy Pascal, the white woman at Sony, where she resigned, and they were making all these racist jokes about President Obama and Kevin Hart and 12 Years a Slave. I didn't hear anybody say, well, maybe that way of thinking, that type of racist sentiment is widespread amongst white people who are in position to vote for who's going to get an Oscar, who's going to get an Academy Award nomination. I didn't hear a single person bring that up at all. And that's the sort of thing, as widespread as that was, as many people were talking about that. This is not ancient history. This happened barely over a year ago. I am sure people remember that. And that seems like an easy one to me in terms of just making connections as to why things happen. That would be one. Two, as I said, Bill Maher, they talked about that for a sizable chunk of time on the program that he did last night. He did not say that whites were racist. He didn't reference the Sony emails either. What he said was that Asians are really racist and that they don't like seeing black people, and that whites in Hollywood have to pretend that they're racist so that they can market their films globally. That astounding, in my view, no problem blasting billions of quote-unquote Asian people, non-white people, as racist, but the white people that are right here, oh, no, they're not, we don't know what, they're pretending to be racist, maybe, or we don't know what the problem is, but Asians, racist, white people, it could be a lot of different things. Bill Maher as well, this is someone who talks about environmental issues all the time. He had Al Gore on last week. They spent the whole first chunk of the program talking about global warming and climate issues and the environment. We got to protect this. You know, we got to do things. They talked about that a little bit last night. I don't recall. I could be in error. You know, folks can set me straight, but I pretty much watch Bill Maher every week that it's been on. I've been watching it every week, you know, that it comes on for years now, just paying attention to the racism in the program. I don't recall him saying anything about the water situation in Flint, Michigan. He did bring it up last night, but, I mean, it was brief. It was super brief, and then they moved on to something else. That sort of thing, in my mind, just phenomenal act of racism, white supremacy, and really showing where his priorities are, even though he claims to be so concerned about the environment and making sure that we take care of this and environmental regulation and being serious. This is a major problem worldwide on the planet. Ta-Nehisi Coates, we did his book, Between the World and Me, just the end of last year. He did a great piece on Bernie Sanders. Came out this week. Bernie Sanders said he would not support reparations for black people in the U.S., and Ta-Nehisi Coates did just, in my view, outstanding piece talking about this. It's at The Atlantic. It's titled Why Bernie Sanders Against Reparations. I am not in support of Bernie Sanders or anybody else, but I think he makes some good points because I think Mr. Sanders said that he thought it would be divisive to support reparations, and he just points out that many of the stance, many of the positions that he has taken, single payer health care system, many of those, free tuition for colleges, many of those would be divisive. I would submit that the entire election process is divisive. You have people arguing and name calling. They do that with great fervor for about a year and a half or so. That whole process is divisive, and people go ahead and do that. Doing the correct thing might not be popular, but you do the correct thing. Great piece. You can check it out. Come to your own conclusions. One other thing I was going to get in before we get to the program. I'll save it for later. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. Code again is 564-943-POUND. If you dialed in, if you could watch the background noise, and if you could be cognizant that other people are on the line who also would like to comment, so make sure that everybody has an opportunity to share. Thank you kindly. Share one time and then allow other folks to speak. If you dialed in, your line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Briefly, before I get started, I happen to have the sound down on the television, and I am watching the beautiful Serena Williams kicking some white females behind on this tennis match. But her beauty is stunning. And if I had a daughter, I would wish that she looked like Serena Williams. But anyway, one first thing comes to my mind is about the six white females. They will probably be mothers of future races. They will be gainfully employed. And if you meaning non-white black person stay on your job working long enough, they will end up being your supervisor or coworker as a success or a successful entrepreneur if they care to quote unquote have their own business. And even though I've heard images stay in cyberspace forever, forgiveness is rendered to young white people when they don't stay on point with refined racist procedure, which is probably the only thing that they may have violated, was being refined in their behavior. Number two, I have no problem with not showing up to an award show on your job. Most people's jobs have some sort of award program also. And I didn't show up to none of mine. But under the system of white supremacy, white people are not going to turn over control of images. As an entertainment employee, and you work for a white arranged company, do your best to get your coins. Do your best to get your payment as best you can. But I caution you to do not measure success by what whites say is good or not good. A black person may become an executive like Mr. Obama, but you would never set policy as long as there is a system of racist white supremacy, unless I'm just talking crazy. You know, that's not going to happen. Broadcasting your disapproval may indicate that you look for white people to validate your work. This will be a self-respect issue. That's my report on those two things. And by the way, before you end up going to workplace racism, I have a reference to I was doing some studying on the internet, and I came upon the first female to be executed in the state of Florida was actually a slave by the name of Cecilia. She was executed because she killed her master. And I say more power to Miss Cecilia. May she rest in peace. Other than being the slave master, he deserved to get killed just off of that alone, he probably was trying to rape her in the process. And in the process of attempting to do that, she killed him. So rest in peace, Miss Cecilia, and let somebody else speak their piece. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so one of the things when a firefighter just laid it out about those four girls, one thing he left out is they could potentially be future wives of black men. We just made a mistake when we were young. I just think that those kids' faces should have been put out there. I just don't understand why black people are so in need of white validation that they have to be awarded by white people for doing something. I never got the Oscars. I could care less about the Grammys. And I just wish that, everyone felt the same way, the actors. And, put out your own movie. Put out what you want to. Who cares if they like it? You put out what you think needs to come out. Hillary, you just talked about Bernie Sanders. I like some of his legislation. One that Scotty Reed talks about a lot. He wants to do away with the private prison corporations, which would be great for us. Reparations. We ain't going to get that. And then after that last story you just played, how many white people are going to come on that line and say, hey, my great-grandfather was black or half black. I got some black in me. You'll never be able to get that out. During a debate last week, when Hillary played the proverbial race card against him, tying him to say, you don't support Obama, and, getting a big response from a mostly black audience in South Carolina. And she also chimed in that he had called Obama in over his head. And he also made a statement in 2012 where he wished that another Democrat would run instead of him. So she played that against him, against that black audience. And the Chicago story you played, the man failed to mention that the prosecutor charged the guy's friends for his murder, even though the cop blatantly shot him in the back. I thought that was very interesting how that they didn't mention that. With all the things they talked about the prosecutor, she turned around and charged his friends with his murder, even though there's a videotape out with the cop shooting him in the back. And lastly, Flint, I hate to say it, but it's another reason why I think blacks don't qualify to be be politicians under a system of racism and white supremacy. You have a black mayor. She's there. She has other people drinking dirty water, and there's absolutely nothing she could do about it. But that's for people all around the country to send water to Flint, Michigan. It's just you're not going to ever be in – have the power to really execute that position. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Those teen girls in Arizona, their faces are out. It was just that particular radio broadcast in Arizona, KTAR, they posted the photograph and they blurred their faces, but the photo is out and the faces are not blurred. If you really want to see what they look like, it would not take, I don't think, more than 60 seconds to do a search online and pop up. I think all the photos that I saw first, their faces were not blurred. That was just, for whatever reason, their station decided to blur their faces. Other folks who dialed in who had a hand up, if you had comments you wanted to get in, feel free to share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everybody. Hello, Cal. This is Gus, caller from the 712. I just took a few notes here that I wanted to point out. Oh, first of all, I want to say, if that was Mr. Cornel West comparing Bernie Sanders to Fannie Lou Hamer, if I read that right, I want to take that back on his confused victim behalf. And I'm a confused victim, too, but that's ridiculous if he compared Bernie Sanders to Miss Fannie Lou Hamer. So I'm taking that back on his behalf. And Whole Squad, the person that was speaking about the Whole Squad, they just lumped all women together as they normally do. The guy said Native women and Asian women and Mexican women and black women and white women. And, yeah, with that, that's their code. And the Flint, Michigan spokeswoman, she first stated that it was civil rights about the water, and then she switched up and she did say water is a basic human right. So, I mean, I'm glad she did that, but she kind of giggled about something at the end. I don't think it's funny at all, not being able to take a shower or wash your clothes, wash your children's hair, wash dishes. They have drinking water, but other things is, I'm just praying for them. And I'm glad that that enslaved woman, she was able to go ahead and murder the slave master, and that's good for her. And I just want to send, you know, positive energy to that ancestor, and all ancestors, including Dr. Wilson. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
That was Dr. West making that comparison to Bernie Sanders and Fannie Lou Hamer. Other folks who dialed in who had a hand up, if you had comments you wanted to get in, if we haven't heard from you, feel free.
Yes, hello?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard? Yeah, well, first-time caller. Good evening to everyone. Call in, the host. I just wanted to say that my name is Dee, first of all, and I am a paid intern for the Bernie Sanders campaign, and I just want to say I experience racism every day working on a campaign, intense racism, but anywho, let's see. well, I had a little bit of workplace racism. Gus, is a you going to talk about that later on? Or?
Absolutely. We get, okay. I think, okay. A little less than an hour. We'll hit workplace racism.
Okay, yeah, sure. But I had a couple more things. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah, about the Oscars. We don't need to infiltrate on what they have going on. We should create what we have. Well, I mean, we should create with what we have and alienate ourselves from any type of white owned corporations. I don't believe in that. Also, now I totally forgot what I was going to say. I'll just mute myself and just wait until workplace racism. Thank you.
Right on. First time caller. Definitely will be looking forward to hearing your comments on workplace racism, given your internship on the Sanders campaign. Before I nab the next score, you all can just share as you go. You can include this. But if anybody has heard people connecting when they've talked about the Oscars thing, again, that's low priority. But if you have heard people connecting it to those Sony emails where they've been making all the racist jokes and everything in 2014, let me know, because I haven't heard that at all. If I've just been slipping and I didn't check closely enough, then, you know, I'll take that on mine for not doing my diligence. But I haven't seen that. So if anybody has seen that, you can insert that as we roll along. Other folks who have not shared yet, feel free to hop in.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I was driving down the street earlier, just a little anecdote. I saw three people just standing on the sidewalk, and they were just standing there still. So as I got closer, I observed them a little more, and it was two white people and a black person. The two white people, it was a male and a female, and they were dressed up kind of like the white man was in a suit, and the white lady was in a, like, I guess like a working type of business suit for her. And then the black male was, you know, kind of dressed very casually, like a little windbreaker and some jeans and some boots or whatever. And they were, I was just thinking, like, why are they standing there? What are they doing? And I saw that their heads were bowed as if they were praying. And I was just like, wow, they're, you know, practicing white supremacy, you know, even with their so-called religion, when their real religion is white supremacy. So just something I just took note of. I've been talking with my daughter a lot. You know, she's a teenager, and you know, just we sit down and sometimes, you know, we watch TV. We were looking at Dr. Drew, and they were discussing the word nigger. And I was just trying to coach my daughter to it without overwhelming her, just like, hey, you know, Dr. Jewel is not going to say much. He's just going to be the moderator. He's going to be the benevolent white guy. You know, he's going to console people, calm them down, just keep control of the, you know, the arguing between, of course, black people who were, you know, the main point of discussion was just talking about, you know, black people calling each other niggers all the time. And I was just like, hey, I told my daughter, hey, just notice how they'll never, you know, ask Dr. Drew anything and never ask him about the origins of the word and what it really means and who invented the word and who really, you know, they spew, you know, hatred when they say the word. But they're going to spend a lot of energy with they have the, you know, the so-called light-skinned, dark-skinned, black, non-whites, you know, black people that were really arguing with each other. And then, you know, you have the feminine, you know, black men, males on there that were, you know, discussing it. I think Don Lemon, he was on there, anti-sexual. I shouldn't say that, but they were all just arguing, you know, over this N-word. And I was just trying to coach my daughter, hey, listen, you know, just see the dynamics of this, because it's not, you know, don't take it just for what you think it is. You know, you have to think about why they're not asking certain questions, whatever. And I believe my daughter's really starting to understand stuff. I'm trying not to overwhelm her to where, you know, sometimes you can overload their senses and they kind of like, hey, you know, Dad, would you shut up? Are you crazy or whatever? But, you know, I think she's starting to get it. And then, you know, they were really pushing the I Have a Dream speech on them, on my youngest daughter and my teenage daughter. And, you know, I read through it with them, and, you know, I just told them, and, oh, man, it was just like I was really thinking about the cows. It was like a lot of metaphors in that speech, even though, again, much, much, much respect to a warrior, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but I was just noticing, I told my daughter, hey, it's the reason why they keep pushing this one speech, I Have a Dream. Man, it was just filled with metaphors, metaphors, metaphors. It was no type of direct, concise, you know, language in that speech. Not too much, anyway. And lastly, I'd like to say the word coon, man, it's really being thrown out there by black people calling other black people coons. Coon. We need to stop it. We really need to stop it and really focus on questioning white people, persistent, consistent questioning of white people and their racism, and stop calling people coons. That's all I have for right now. Thanks.
Amen. Amen. No name calling. Dr. Welsing would be super proud if more of us could put that in place. No name calling black people. No name calling black people. No name calling black people. Other folks, send right on for counter-racist parenting. Other folks who had a hand up, do y'all have comments you wanted to make sure you got in? Yes, Topello. Good to hear from you, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I'm not sure if everybody knows this, but the city of Flint was under emergency powers by the governor. So the governor, he's the guy who had everything under control in Flint. So the mayor was powerless. And then I guess after everything hit the fan, all of a sudden she got some power back. So I don't know how much power she got back, but we'll see how it goes. They brought it up on the Madison show. If anybody listens to the Joe Madison show, Joe Madison went in on it, and he had to remind some black people who was going off on the mayor as well, on the mayor as well, and he had to let them remind them, because Joe Madison's from Detroit. He had to remind them, he lived in Detroit when he was younger, I guess. And he had to remind them how Flint was under the emergency powers. So I want everybody to understand that there's a lot of cities in Michigan that's under the governor's control. And so, they knew this was going on for a year. And I wanted people to put it just in perspective. You go into a middle desert and put a base in, bring fresh water, airports, and service, 10,000 to 100,000 people at that base in a matter of 6 months. And in a whole year or two, I think it's almost 2 years they've been having this problem. But I'll say a year. They still act like they don't know what to do and how to fix the issue. So that should put things in perspective. And I'll mute my line from here. That's somebody else said.
Governor Rick Snyder, white man, suspected racist. Make sure we get his name in there. Who is most to blame? Governor Rick Snyder, suspected racist. He actually, they had an article in the New York Times yesterday where he said this absolutely has nothing to do with race, which is suspicious in and of itself. Anytime I hear a white person say that about anything, the radar goes off the charts. But that was in the New York Times yesterday. Other folks who dialed in who had a...
Thank you, Gus, for it slipped my mind to name the main racist in charge. I'm glad you helped me with my lack of memory.
For sure. Victim of racism. I know the feeling, man. I know the feeling. Other folks who had a hand up that we haven't heard from yet, feel free to chime in.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, your guest, Kristen Green, the lady that wrote that book about the closure of the schools in Prince Edward County, I know a lot of people were discussing her attitude on the show, which I agree that she was very, I don't know, like she just didn't care about the issue of racism, and especially that purported by her or committed by her family. So I wanted to ask you, do you think that maybe her answers were rehearsed? Maybe she listened to the cows before and she knew how to be manipulative in that way, or do you think that that was just her nature?
I mean, I think that's pretty standard, I would say, for racists across the board. It's pretty typical, particularly when they're talking about, like, relatives and people that they are close to. A lot of the exact same techniques are put into play where their terroristic conduct is going to be minimized, where they're not indicted as racist or they're a product of their times, as she said specifically in the book, and that sort of thing, where they just get let off the hook. We're not going to hold them culpable and use correct terms when we describe what it is that they did. I think that's standard. Now, she certainly could have. She's a journalist, so she certainly could have done her homework, listened to the program before, so she could know how to answer questions and that sort of thing. But, I mean, I've seen that across the board, even from people when I'm talking to whites when they're not on the program. So, you know, they haven't researched me as Gus or anything like that or the cows. I see that as standard operating procedure on the part of whites in terms of deflecting and minimizing the racist acts that they and other white people carry out, past, present, future. Does that answer?
Yeah, it does. Okay, thank you. And then lastly, I haven't got a chance to just share my grief, and I'm sorry I'm about to cry, over the death of Dr. Welsing. It's just a huge loss. Thank you.
Agreed, Ashe. Monumental loss. Monumental loss. I know a lot of folks are still grieving over that, and... be not discouraged. I know I heard Dr. Welsing say it in the archives when she was on before, be not discouraged. And again, just use, she left just a monumental accumulation of work for us to go back and review what she, her works, her writings, and her thoughts on what's happening and what we need to do as black people to manifest black self-respect and go about solving this problem. So, absolutely. I think a lot of us are still going through the grieving process, and even with that, still trying to do the work that she was doing with her life and energy, replacing white supremacy with justice. So soldiering on, but I know a lot of us are in the same position.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, guys, to the Kyle's listeners. I definitely wanted to share just a little bit about the clips. The clip in particular that I took note on was the commentary between the two white men about the six girls who, you know, had the T-shirts. And what I found interesting was their issue, from what I got out of it, was more so the fact that they put it on social media. And one of the gentlemen kept saying, you know, talk to your children about social media, not the behavior, not the offense, not, you know, the fact that it was more so wrong. But the one guy kept stressing that, well, you know, you put it on social media and you're not going to be able to get a job. Although we know that's not going to be the case, but that is the message to me, was them stressing how, you know, to teach our children to be more refined. And I thought that was interesting. And then the other person that was talking was, you know, trying to say, well, they just didn't understand what the word means. And I thought that was just funny. I just couldn't believe that was just the conversation. So I took note of that. Also, the Flint residents, I read somewhere where they're still being billed. They're getting shut off notices for the poisoned water and contaminated water, and that's typical. I just thought that was interesting that they're still being billed. And threatened shut off of contaminated water, like whoop-de-doo. I thought that was crazy. Also, I did hear Neely Fuller on another program. I think he comes on Wednesdays. And I agree with your last comment, Gus, regarding really reading and taking advantage of all the information that Dr. Welsing left. You know, sometimes we just tend to take each day for granted, in my opinion. And I just regret all the opportunities that we had, or I had, to ask more questions of her. I have her book, and I haven't read it cover to cover, but I regret that I didn't, to really get an understanding of, you know, or ask questions based off of having the book and being able to have an opportunity when she was here to get more clarity. But she did leave tons of information. There's tons of recordings, and I'm grateful of that. But it just really teaches me not to take any day for granted, any opportunity to learn how this system works, especially with individuals or opportunities like this to be on this program and just chime in and get information, because we never know when our last day here is. But it just really make it crystal clear for me not to take any day for granted, or the people that we have that are fighting to help us in this cause for granted. So I just wanted to share that, and I'll also chime back in for workplace racism. Thanks.
Ashe. Yeah, I noted that same trend with the young racists in Arizona, young female racists on top of it, that this is a social media problem, and we need to have the counselors go through and look at their Twitter account and Facebook, other social media sites, to make sure they don't have anything inappropriate, and the parents talk to them about not, oh, wow, these, you know, young chicks are racist. And why, I thought, you know, so many people have said young people are not going to be carrying this forward, and we're making so much progress. Not that, just, hey, we need to be a little bit better about how we manifest and publicly, anyway, express our racism. I thought that was profound. But even that, I would say, is pretty standard. They, on Bill Maher yesterday, they brought up the white female from, I think it was like a year and a half ago, Justine Sacco. She was the one who tweeted. She was on a plane, I think, and she tweeted that she was on her way to the continent, Africa, and she was going to have sex, I think. And she said she was going to Africa. She hoped she didn't get AIDS. That was what she tweeted, among some other things. And it caused a big brouhaha. They alleged that she got fired, transferred. She got another job, but they brought it up last night. And they were saying, man, people write something on social media or Twitter. They make a joke and, you know, everybody gets all offended. And, you know, the person's life is ruined. He mentioned her specifically, this woman, Justine Sacco, for her tweets and saying her life was ruined. And I was like, really? Are you serious? Like, people in Michigan dealing with this water situation, their life is ruined. Tamir Rice's family, their life is ruined. This woman, Justine Sacco, is not even unemployed. I saw she just got mentioned a few months back when they had the big controversy with FanDuel, some of these fantasy sports sites online, where she's working for one of these firms. And they just brought that up as a little addendum. In the report, I've seen nothing, no information at all where her life is ruined, where she's homeless and living in a cardboard box or something like that, or people are trying to kill her and making threats. Nothing. It's just standard operating procedure of racism, white supremacy, where they all, just like Kristen Green, as I said before, where they minimize the terroristic conduct of whites all the time. Other folks who dialed in who have comments if we haven't heard from. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. I did hear a female.
Greetings to you. Oh, okay. Let the female go first. I'll go after her.
Right on.
Oh, no, you can go ahead. I'll catch my breath while you...
Okay, thank you very much, sis. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Greetings to you, Gus, and to all the callers. Yeah, this snowstorm is a killer, just to let you know. I had over six foot snow drift at the base of my... I can't wait to see what tomorrow's going to bring when I wake up. But yeah, these clips are really interesting. To speak about this, these six white girls who spelled nigger out on their shirts on Instagram, I first saw that actually on cynicalafrican.com. And next to the image of the smiling, gleeful white supremacist, there was an image of one of the white girls with a black male. I think he had his arm around her and he was wearing a suit. And she had a big skinning and grinning, predatory white grin in the picture as well. And it just made me think of the fact that, you know, we always talk about the fact that white people can, you know, have sex with us. They can buy us things, be nice to us, give us money when we're in need, and still be a racist white supremacist. And just the fact that they would show her in this image, you know, gleefully standing next to this black male, I'm sure he had no idea he was standing next to a predator, which a lot of us don't understand that. And then she showed her true colors in the image that Cynical African put directly next to that. And it also made me think of, I think it was a year ago, a little over a year ago, Iggy Azalea, she's actually been dating a black male basketball player. I forget his name right now. And I remember a little over a year ago, there was a controversy because she had a song that had lyrics where she referred to herself as a runaway slave master. So that line in and of itself lets me know that she knows exactly what her position is in the world as a white woman, and she's consciously choosing to sexually assault a black male basketball player, of course, who needs white validation in the form of sexual contact with a white predatory person. And also the clip with the Oscars is, I mean, I'm just so disgusted with the whole idea of white validation and each one of the black artists, producers, filmmakers who have come out to speak about the lack of inclusiveness in the arena of entertainment is really a joke to me, because ultimately we should know this by now. And I mean, I look at black history, just we used to have our own black basketball leagues, and we canceled that to get white validation to become a part of the NBA. We had the Negro baseball leagues. We stopped doing that in order to join white people again for white validation in the baseball league, where we're still, you know, treated and talked about as niggas, monkeys, and coons to this day. And in this, it's just we need to have our own award ceremonies, and not on BET or any of those other white-controlled trash stations, but just stuff that we're able to do for ourselves. And I just believe that the whole concept of white validation is actually nauseating. And that brings me to, weirdly enough, today I was watching Finding Your Roots, the most recent episode, and they had Shonda Rhimes and Keenan Ivory Wayans. And I thought about Shonda Rhimes as she was learning all of this information about the horrible experiences that her African-American African ancestors had gone through in this country. And she is, and I'll take the term that Neely Fuller provides in the code book, but she plays a most powerful eight baller for white supremacy in the way that she creates her programs, which sexually debase and basically shows the effacement of black sexuality and basically the rape of black women on television, and them consciously allowing themselves to be subjugated by white males in the form of Kerry Washington's character and the other sister on How to Get Away with Murder. And I just found that interesting. And then for the Kenan Ivory Wayans section, they found out that I think it was the second or third great-grandfather was actually the personal assistant and slave of a South Carolina governor. And that when they went on a trip to Canada, as an affront to the governor, they kidnapped him because he seemed to have had a very tight bond with this governor. And he also had a lot of family members. They seemed to have kept his family together under the jurisdiction of that. I think he owned over 600 slaves. He was one of the richest slaves in South Carolina, slave owners at the time. And when they kidnapped him, he actually went back home. So instead of staying in Canada and remaining free, he actually went back into bondage. And, Kenan Ivory Wayans made a joke about it. He said, I thought, my ancestor would run away like Harriet Tubman. And this one went back. And then he thought about it and he said, it would not have been true freedom for him to have left his family members like he did. And I remember in the article that they wrote about this man, they claimed that in his own words that he was content with his situation as a slave. And I was like, wow, they were practicing racism and white supremacy in the 1800s because I know he wasn't content with that. What he was content with was being close to his family. In reference to the Danny Holzcore clip, I think maybe they do not see him as a white person in order for him to have gotten 263 years. We'll see if that really sticks because I know they're going to go for an appeal. So essentially, hopefully, it'll be able to stick after the appeals process all of the appeals processes are exhausted and he can rot where he belongs and get what he truly deserves. And I found it interesting that in that clip that the reporter used the term compromised black women, compromised Hispanics, Asians, and so forth. And of course, he had to add the lily white colorless people to the mix. But just the fact that he used the term compromise really speaks, how would they be compromised except for in a system of racism, white supremacy? So, of course, he was practicing racism by not even finishing the actual sentence in a proper manner. And in reference to Flint, Michigan, it's really disgusting what's going on in that area of the country. And it really, really makes you think, because I was reading an article earlier today that said there's quite a few Americans that are receiving water in lead-laden pipes, exactly like the ones in Flint, Michigan, because a lot of the water systems are over 100 years old. But in a lot of those systems, in those water systems, because of the fact that it would be too costly for them to remove these lead pipes, what they do is they put additives in the water that gets rid of the lead content or reduces it to a point that's supposedly safe for human consumption. And why wasn't that done in Flint, Michigan? It's because there's people of African descent in Flint, Michigan. And lastly, I found the clip on Karen Brennan really fascinating. I think you should try and get her on the show. I just find it really interesting, the fratricide between her white and black family members and how that had played out. And it just goes to show how incorrect sex between non-white people and white people truly is. And also because the family story really reminded me of Hatfields and McCoys. But I think that's a fascinating story, and maybe we should try and get her on the show. And the last thing I wanted to talk about was that I saw an article with Donald Trump. And Donald Trump said he believes that his supporters are so loyal that if he stood on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan and shot somebody, they were still backing for president. And it just immediately made me think of Ben Tillman and the fact that Ben Tillman was able to kill black senators and assault people, and his family was involved in all kinds of duels, and he was still lauded and given the senatorship and all these other different political places to run, jurisdiction over, excuse me. And he just reminds me of Ben Tillman. And that was the last thing I wanted to say. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Here. I'm also thought it would be good if we could see if we can get Ms. Brennan on the program, who wrote that book, The Family Tree. That was kind of the last clip in the program about the lynching in Georgia. See if we can make that happen. Just quickly, with the Daniel Holzclaw situation, that was not the reporter who used the term compromised black females. That was a white attorney who was there who used that term. Just important clarification, but you all didn't have the video to see all that.
Thanks for the correction.
Oh, for sure. Other folks who dialed in, who had comments, if we have not heard from you, feel free. I think the female caller, did you want to go ahead now, the female caller?
Yeah, Gus, good evening. And good evening to all of the listeners. I want to talk about something a little different tonight. I want to talk about the standoff in Oregon, mainly because it's such a glaring, bold, profound example of white privilege. You know, when we look at what happened to Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, they were victims. Yet the media went into their background and, of course, tried to make it look as though they deserved what they got. This is always the thing that the media does. But in the case of white men, they don't do that. They never question the background of white men. That bunch that's up there, that's in Oregon, most of them are criminals. They're criminals, and they're living off the system. Just yesterday, I read that one of the men up there is a man named Neil Wampler. He's a convicted murderer. He killed his father. Then you have John Ritzheimer. He's the little bald guy that the media has made a star out of him. He claims to have been in the Marines. It looks like he was in the Marines. Why he left, we don't know. But Ritzheimer is on disability. Okay, then you've got the one that crashed the government vehicle. He was had already been convicted of another crime that involved land, about setting fires. And so then you have the main spokesperson is a man by the name of Blaine Cooper. And Blaine Cooper, his real name is Stanley Blaine Hicks. Stanley Blaine Hicks is a multiple felon. He uses the name Blaine Cooper. He took that name from the movie Predator, starring Jesse Ventura. It is the most ridiculous. I mean, you haven't heard any of this about their characters in the mainstream media. These guys have been going around the country, not just this ordeal in Oregon. They are the same bunch that had this thing called Operation American Spring a couple of years ago, where they were going to go into Washington and arrest President Obama. It's the same crew. They show up. Then they had something like Truckers Against the Truckers for the Constitution. Same bunch of men. The one that famous photo of a gentleman at the first Bundy standoff pointing an assault rifle at federal officers. His name is Eric E.J. Parker. He was never arrested. As a matter of fact, he's in Oregon right now. So a lot of these people, a lot of those men up there are criminals. Their background is never checked. Bundy himself, the son, is living off the government dole. He has a $500,000 loan that he got from the Small Business Association, and he hasn't paid a dime on it. Of course, his father still owes the government $1 million. It's just stunning to me. Well, it's not stunning. It makes me angry that even President Obama, they went back to demeaned his parents, went back to his parents and put out all kinds of horrible things about his parents. But this lot that you see in Oregon, as well as this whole right-wing element, a lot of those guys are mentally ill, criminals, and living off the dole themselves.
I mean, the fact that they can stay up there for that long tells you they don't have jobs, you know. So I just thought I would get that in, Gus.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. I do want to make sure I get in. I try to say this consistently. I would really appreciate it if people never use the term white privilege on this program. And for exactly all of the elements that you just pointed out, in every facet of what you pointed out, to be white and criminal and you can go and do all this, get your guns and be on federal property and say we're not going to leave. And damaging, destroying federal property that we were talking about last week, how they were cutting down fences and going on government computers and getting addresses, home addresses for government employees and spying on them and all this other stuff that they've been doing as this is unfolded. In my view, that does not qualify as white privilege. That is white power. That is white supremacy.
Well, I stand corrected, Gus. Thank you for correcting me.
And really, white people like Timothy Wise and the gang, they are most responsible for that, because it's the same pattern of not just getting us to not use the most correct terms to describe what this is. And I've said consistently, privilege just makes it kind of seem like, you know, everything is more or less all right, but I just get a little bit more goodies than you. And that's not what this is at all. When you have whites who can go out with guns and say, we're going to do this today, and what are you going to do about it? That is a display, in my opinion, of white force, white violence, white power. And I think we would serve our own interests just using the most accurate terms possible. White privilege is not an accurate term to describe what it is that white folks are doing, white men and white women.
Absolutely.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
How you doing, Gus? Just to let everybody know, I'm in the East Coast of Washington, D.C. I've been at work since Friday, snowed in. I had to do security, and so what they did is they paid us to come in early to stay overnight. So I've been here since Friday, 5 o'clock. I just finished my shift. I'm about to crash, and I may pull another shift at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So I probably won't get home till about Monday. So that's how I'm doing here in Washington, D.C. over this blizzard weekend. But, Gus, I wanted you to possibly explain something to me. You've probably explained it before, but I know I was listening to a video that you did on the Iceman back in 2010, and one of the things that you asked the host was to be very concise in his answers, and I think he seemed like he got a little offended. He was kind of like, well, you know, I don't really want to dumb down anything. And you was like, well, please be very concise. And I was like, and if people don't understand, then I will explain it. You know, then you kind of went back and forth. And then I've noticed whenever you've had various white guests on the show, you would ask them to be very concise. And I think I must have missed something when you explained it. Can you go back and explain it to me, please, real fast, why you do that in the sense of, I guess, to alleviate a lot of foolishness, but I must have missed something.
Yes, sir. It's, well, number one, I hope you are staying warm, staying safe. That sounds horrendous, and I hope, you know, you're able to escape soon and get out of that predicament, being stranded at the job, but... with regards to asking white guests in particular to be concise, it's been my experience that frequently that's one of the ways that white people practice white supremacy racism. They will talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. And after you've listened to them for half an hour, they have not answered your question. They have used buckets and buckets of words. I think we've had that clip on the program for a few years now. And they will not use the most accurate terms. Well, they will talk and give you a response that where they've used about 500 different terms where they could have responded accurately and used 50 words. And it's just, it's my view. And I've had, you know, white people admit that this is one of the ways that they use racism, white supremacy. It's a part, in my view, it's a part of being deceptive when you are not being clear, you're not being accurate, and you're being unnecessarily wordy. You're being the term that you circumloquacious in giving your response, where they just pussyfoot around and beat around the bush and are just not providing clarity. And then if you get lost in this typhoon of words, or you don't understand because they're obfuscating and not being clear, then it's all, well, you're just ignorant, you're stupid. Michael Bradley, I think you're referencing with Iceman Inheritance. Well, then they talk down to you and they get very arrogant about it. Well, you're just too ignorant to understand, you and your puny Negro brain. You're just not understanding what I'm trying to tell you. And a lot of us, we've been so victimized, myself included, where our self-respect is not up. But we believe that. Like, yeah, this white man is so smart. This white woman is so smart. And my niggerish brain, I'm just not able to understand what they're saying. And that's not it at all. They're just being deliberately confusing and not clear. And a major tactic of that is to just use lots and lots and lots and lots of words. So that's one of the things that I try to do to counter that, is to get to the point as quickly as you can. You can give us a full answer without talking for 5 years. And I hope that answers your question.
Yes, and it also pretty much explained the comments, because one of the comments from 2005, actually you did an interview in 2010, but somebody commented in 2005 saying that, well, maybe I felt like the host was beating up the guest, maybe his people didn't understand, and they were pretty much saying exactly what you said. Maybe they stupid, because I felt like he was answering the question, but they kept going backwards and forwards, and I was like, I must have missed something. So I'm glad you explained that to me, and I appreciate it, and I'll mute my line.
Right on. We're going to get to workplace racism in about 8 minutes. Everybody who has dialed in with a hand up, if you haven't shared yet, if you had comments, you should go now, because we are going to workplace racism promptly.
Hello?
I heard
Hello?
Two different people. No, we're all males, I'm not sure. I guess the caller at 4743, I don't think have we not heard from you yet? 4743, last four digits.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you, Gus. I'm a first-time caller. I've listened to the show for, I guess, a little over a year now, and I was one of those people that, you know, meant to call to speak to Dr. Welving and kept saying next time, and, you know, I'm sorry, and I guess it took her death to finally make me call, and I'd like to apologize for that, and thank you for all your hard work.
Oh, I say, right on.
And thing I like to mention is this documentary on Netflix that everybody's been buzzing about is called Making a Murderer. It's definitely worth watching if you're a black person. This is about a white guy, and I think the reason they made this documentary is because a white guy got seriously, seriously railroaded by the justice system, and it just made me see that there is no such thing as a justice system. And I'm sure that thousands and thousands of blacks have gotten worse treatment than this guy's gotten, railroaded even worse. But because it's a white guy, it's got national attention, and it's definitely worth watching. And the second thing I like to mention is that earlier the black man stated that that we shouldn't use the word coon, but I guess that's accurate. But, you know, there needs to be some type of penalty for these people that go out here and try to minimize things that happen to black people. I noticed that black people happen. There's like lines and lines of black people going on Fox News saying that white people are justified in just dismissing the stuff that goes on with black people. I don't see that with other races. I have yet to hear one white person say George Zimmerman was guilty. I mean, even 20 years from now, we're going about to see another movie on O.J. Simpson. They have not given up on that. I mean, black people need a code of conduct. And these black people that go against that code need some type of punishment or to be shamed in some type of way. And that's all I want to say, and thanks.
Right on. I'm going to nab the other folks because we are closing in on workplace racism, but just for the latter portion, certainly VGQ, everybody is qualified to take their own stance. The thing that I say consistently about all of that, because I've heard that conversation for many, many years, that there needs to be some sort of penalty for black people who violate the code or who are doing things to support racist man, racist woman. Number one, who's going to enforce that penalty? That is a question. What's the penalty going to be? What should be done about all these people? Those are questions that I ask consistently, because it seems like this has been a problem for many, 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 many years, and we have not figured that out. I definitely do not encourage, support. In fact, I would vehemently oppose any such conduct, because we invest a lot of time complaining about other victims of racism. If we're not name-calling black people, in my view, the most accurate term to describe those individuals who go on Fox and say things to minimize racism, white supremacy, or stick up for George Zimmerman, or whatever the case may be, is victims of racism, white supremacy. It's very easy, as long as white people have more power than we do, to use victims in that manner. In my view, white people are most to blame for all of that behavior, all of the non-white people who are doing things against black self-interest. But there are many, many people who are very excited and invest a lot of time and energy in saying that, yes, we need to have some sort of penalty in place, and we need to go after the black people that are not doing right and invest a lot of time and energy name-calling those black people. That's not this program. Anybody that we have not heard from who has comments that they would like to get in, feel free.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, really quick on the clip with the gentleman in his cell phone. I had to take a training course some years ago, and I was the only non-white person in his training course. The instructor told us that if you unholster your weapon, brandish your weapon, and someone is running away, keep your firearm on that person until you can't see them anymore, just in case that they can turn around and shoot over their shoulder. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And then also I had something else to share in non-relation to any of the clips. A few years ago, my fiance got a phone call like 5 a.m. And she was crying. I asked her what happened. She said that her cousin had been shot and was killed. Interestingly, I found out that her cousin was shot and killed on my sister's block 2 days after my little brother told me that my nephew, who I had cut out of my life a long time ago because of his gang activity, had been arrested for shooting 3 people and killing 1. Later on that day, I found out that the one person that was killed was my fiance's cousin. And still to this day, I haven't said anything to her about it, and I haven't really talked about it. So I was wondering if anyone could give me some feedback on, like, should I say something? Or my nephew is actually on his way home. I think he did 4 years for the murder. They gave him manslaughter or something like that. So, yeah, I was just confused, and I didn't know, should I say something or not say something or what?
It's going to be challenging because hang on a second. It's going to be just a challenge because we are going to workplace racism, as I said, promptly. We get about 60 seconds, and this is something we could have spent a lot more time on. I definitely think.
Sorry about that, guys.
No, it's not an apology at all. Just, you know, time constraints. Time is always against us. But definitely, I think truth. I generally try to err on the side of truth because I think a lot of times problems come up when people don't have accurate information or they get the accurate information way, 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 way late down the road. So I generally try to err on the side of truth so that people know, you know, exactly what happened, even if it's something that's going to be painful or what have you. That's certainly, you know, wanting to reveal truth in a manner that's going to promote correctness and not going to have further conflict and create more problems. And certainly this is such a traumatic situation all the way around. It would definitely be a delicate issue. We probably need a little bit more time. If this is one that you want to discuss more about, we can make time for that so we can have more time. People can kind of give their suggestions, give their thoughts, and maybe even get somebody who has some counseling expertise on how to deal with these sort of issues where you have a major family crisis of this nature, and the best way to kind of share this and dialogue about it and reveal truth so you all can deal with it, process the best way that you can, and figure out how people want to move forward.
Okay, no problem. Thank you, guys.
I'm sorry for your loss. That is horrendous situation. And again, I would submit whites are most to blame. We will take one other person, and then we're going to workplace racism. You'll have you can get 60 seconds. If there's anybody else who's on the line who has not shared at all, if you would like to comment, you can get 60 seconds.
Yes, I have shared, but I had one more comment.
Wait a minute. Do we have anybody who has not shared at all? Is anybody who has not shared at all who's on the line?
Okay, sorry.
Not
can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Just speak up, sir.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to say peace to everybody. And I just think that, in my observation, that the system of racism on white supremacy, which should be considered sophisticated terrorism, is definitely going through an update right now based upon, you know, the stuff that we claim that we know or that we're working to voice and things like that. And I just think that, you know, the system of racism, white supremacy is going through an update. And, you know, like Neely Fuller Jr. said, the cost of doing business in the system of racism, white supremacy is going up. And I just wanted to point out once again, you know, Dr. Francis Cresswell and what I would call concept of the creator or God or something like that. You know, I think the clip that you played in the beginning where she talked about the real white supremacy and how she kind of didn't mention God or the creator or this, but you can kind of hear or, you know, that I think that I heard that she kind of, that was her source of happiness and energy. And, you know, at a time like this, after her passing, you know, a lot of sentiments have been made towards the area of religion, but not clearly spoken. So, you know, I just want to clearly outline that I think that Francis Cresswell and did believe in the creator or God or Allah, however people decide to express it. But I do think that that was the source of her diligence and why she did what she did.
Ashe, we will leave it there and transition to workplace racism. I will say, just because I know it's a very popular sentiment, and I know a lot of people who listen to the COWS program do not agree with many things that, you know, I say or other people share on the program, and that's fine. VGQ, and I know one of those points is about going after quote-unquote sellouts, Toms, Sambos, whatever other names people want to call it, just black people that they feel are helping racist man, racist woman. All of the evidence that I've seen, you compile your list of the top 100 black sellouts, black traitors, 500,000. If all of them died today, nothing would improve about our position. Flat statement, could be incorrect, but I have seen no evidence. Whomever you think is messing it up most for the black team, if they died right now, nothing about our position would improve. Moving forward to workplace racism, we had a person that wrote in a comment right on point, their commentary on Martin Luther King Jr. weekend. Last weekend, a 27-year-old black female got drunk at a family member's home, tripped walking down the stairs to go home, twisted her ankle, somehow got a severe digestive problem, and came to work with her ankle wrapped. She was bent over her desk a good portion of the day in intense intestinal pain, as we are not allowed unscheduled days off. She told me despite all this, she is still not done with alcohol. If only we understood, sobriety would be best. Somebody says that frequently on this program. Workplace racism, if folks have comments that they would like to share, the number again is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-POUND. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Folks have commentary on workplace racism. Proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I am a salesman of some sort. In Alabama, and I have a company car. I'm at a stop account. I park my company car And I go into the store to, you know, do my job, make sales, wine. And I come out to find out that somebody had hit my car. Told by people in the parking lot, witnesses who had who witnessed the incident. You know, they were joking, laughing. Two white males, and they said that the guy caught his the guy had messed up his car, but my car did not get, you know, messed up or, you know, a scratch on it. But the guy had fled the scene. And, you know, I just had a problem with it because I know in Alabama, hitting a car, fleeing a car accident, a scene is a felony. And, you know, they were just joking and laughing. And, you know, they was like, man, well, your car's not messed up. The guy had a brand new truck, white, older male, and it shouldn't be a problem. And, you know, listening to the program and understanding the racism, you know, I knew in my head, you know, if I hit a car and flee a scene, then, you know, I'd probably be charged. I you know, I'd get in trouble. It'd be a problem. But these guys, they were just very nonchalant. And so I went inside and I spoke with the general manager over the grocery store I was at. And I asked him to file a police report and get the sheriff out there or whatever, you know. And he's a white male, and he and it was the same response, you know what I'm saying, laughing, joking, because, you know, they claimed that I did not have any type of damage to my company car. But, you know, I mean, to me, it wasn't any visible damage neither, but still, like, you know, the next day the light can go out and, you know, I'd be irresponsible. So, I mean, I just didn't understand because not only it was a felony, but, I mean, you're still not supposed to flee the scene. And, you know, they, you know, laughing about it. I can see his parts of his truck on the ground around my car. But, I mean, I guess that didn't mean anything. I still, you know, felt the need to file a report or something because my brake light, you know, can go out the next day or anything can happen. And I guess because it was a white male, they didn't really care. But, yeah, that and also I told the day that the five peaceful protesters were shot by a terrorist. Out there, the I think his name was Clark or Claw. They were shot, and that was I'm assuming a terrorist attack, you know, by the definition. So I came to work and told my manager that it was a terrorist attack that day in Indianapolis. I think that's where it happened at. And, you know, he ran off, pissed off, and mad, and came back, and he was mad at me. And he was like, man, that's not cool. And I was like, what you mean? It was a terrorist attack. And I guess he expected it to be some type of Muslims or brown people committing a terrorist attack. But that's it. That's all I had.
Huh.
I'm keeping my line.
Thank you for sharing, sir. That, number one, the latter portion of what you shared about going to work and telling them it was a terrorist attack in Minneapolis. You're talking about the Jamar Clark, where the folks affiliated with Black Lives Matter, they were protesting, and they shot five of the protesters. I think that was November 2015. That sounds almost like a counter-racist experiment to go in and say, classify this as a terrorist attack, because that language was not used when that incident got reported from most of what they call mainstream media. to see how white people respond to that. And that is fascinating, his response being, oh, man, that's not cool. What are you doing talking about a terrorist attack? That's just some niggas that got shot moving forward. No surprise at all, but that is fascinating. The first one, that is revealing as well, because it's been my experience, anything like that happens on the job, where it could be destruction of property or any sort of vehicle collision or anything like that, it's been my experience that white people tend to be sticklers about that sort of thing. Like, whoa, we got to get all the details and take, 50 photographs and call all the people and get a full report and everything filled out for them to just laugh and chuckle. Exactly what you said. Anything could happen. Like you said, if the brake light goes out the next day or anything like that, and then you end up being held accountable. Or if we switch the situation around, if it had been you that was responsible, if you had, struck another vehicle or what have you and there was minor damage, would they have handled this in the same way and just laugh, joke, oh, no, we don't need to have a police report? Particularly, you said that this person, this white guy, left the scene, hit your vehicle, company vehicle, and left the scene, which is supposed to be, that's criminal activity. Would they have done that if this had been you? That might even be a good question to ask. Like, is this the procedure? If I, strike a vehicle in the company car and, I deem it that, hey, this it's no real damage here, what have you, to just say, hey, leave. No.
Yeah, listen, and I still didn't get a police report filed or any type of, accurate response to the incident. They still, just played around then, the entire day. And I was just the whole time shocked and in awe that somebody can hit my car and flee the scene and everybody's joking about it. But I wasn't at all playing around the whole time. I was deadly serious. And they just, took a joke about it the whole time, laughing at me. And I'm like, man, we need to look at the cameras. We need to get a face. We need to get and they were like, it doesn't matter because you don't have any damage to your car. And, it was a crazy experience, period.
Excellent. Being serious, I recommend that for any situation, if it's a vehicle or something else, to be serious when these type of things happen, because I think consistently that's one of the things that they'll try to do is to get you. They'll be laughing and joking about it, so they'll get you to not take it seriously. You do not want to be pulled into that. I would also, this type of incident, I would big time encourage documentation. I would want to get that in writing, that whoever, the most powerful white person, manager, supervisor, whatever, said we don't need to call the police in this incident, even though there was criminal activity, there was a hit and run where it seemed, you said you could see, parts of the other person's vehicle on the ground around your vehicle, that, hey, we don't think the police need to be called here, even though there's clear wrongdoing, criminal activity. Police don't need to be called, and whatever, course of action they think need to be taken, even if it's none, no course of action needs to be taken. We deem that there's no damage to your vehicle. So, let's all continue about our workday and keep it moving. I would want documentation on that, people to sign off on that. This is what's supposed to be done. And is this standard operating procedure? Is this the typical way that we handle when there's been any sort of collision, minor damage or no? This is the typical way things are handled, that we don't call the police. We just go out and make a quick assessment. No harm, no foul, keep it moving. This is consistently how you all have handled these type of problems.
Absolutely. Thanks, Gus.
For sure. Other folks, if you have workplace racism that you'd like to share or comments, questions, feel free.
Hey, Gus, I had a question for the previous caller. I was going to ask if he actually was able to take photographs of the actual scene where the parts of the other car was there, so that way you at least also have a visual record of what was actually there, so that way that'll be a visual record you have to go along with the written the recording that you would take as far as writing down what happened.
That's a good point though. But they were just saying it was an old white man and blah blah blah, and he ain't know no better. Like it was a joke, but it was really just a attack on my professionalism. Because if that could have occurred, then anything else could occur. I didn't take any photographs. That's a good point.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Absolutely.
Yes, that's very important on what the last caller brought up, and we have to be very meticulous on jobs because it would, by not doing it, it a lot of times it'll come back on you. But I wanted to speak about the mindset of white people on jobs that are quote unquote in charge. It just came to my mind. I think I must have had some sort of post-traumatic memory of it happening before I retired. But it came to my mind just like it was yesterday, and it's still relevant on everybody else's job. And what I mean by the mindset is the attitude that you get of these white people. For the most part, it's white males as well as white females primarily, whose attitude is that I know more than anybody else, and you can't make any suggestions that I will consider, no matter whether you got more experience than me or not. And the nature of the job that I was on, in a lot of cases, could be life and death. Whether you're on a fire call or whether you're on a rescue call, there are some subtleties that may take place that you don't see that can just come up on everybody. So it'll be incompetent and wise for whoever's in charge to respect that, and even if a person doesn't have as much experience as they do, to consider what suggestions they have. But I experienced that a lot where that was disregarded for the most part. I mean, it's almost like consistent and determined through these white supervisors. So for the most part, I avoided having, first of all, a quote-unquote white supervisor. Because what I noticed with non-white people on jobs, especially a job that they have life and death circumstances for the public as well as the employees themselves, that non-white black person, from my experiences, end up, they do consider what you have to say. They may not like you. You may not have a quote-unquote good relationship with that non-white black person. But when it comes to life and death, then that person is going to be more open-minded than a white person in my experiences. And I have two examples of the white people. For instance, a lot of people know about the incident that took place off the coast of Florida somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean where that huge freighter sunk. It was a white male that was in charge of that ship, and he made the choice to, instead of wait for the hurricane to go by, which would have heightened their probability of survival, he went right into it. And right now that ship is 10,000 feet below the surface, and the whole crew is down there with it. And they've been that way for several months. And as far as an experience that I can tell you that related that I was directly involved in on the job at Dade County Fire Department. It was a white male who, this was his last day that he was on duty before he retired. Had a call about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, a fire call, one of the most potentially dangerous type of fires, these warehouse fires. They normally take place about 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, that sort of thing. They respond, dispatch tells them, based on the time that the fire was going on, to don't go into a certain part of the warehouse. He went in anyway, claiming, you know, his experience and whatnot, and it ended up costing him his life. The way I know about that, because when we took an arrival on something like a second or third alarm, my job was to spray water over his dead body so the fire would not consume. He was already dead, so the fire would not consume his body at the time. And I made it a practice. I made it a practice to let anybody who needs to know that that I'm not going to lose my life over no building. If I had the chance to make a choice on whether or not I risk my life, that was going to be my choice. And hey, what can they do? Fire me or whatever. Just, I will still live tomorrow as far as they're concerned. But I was determined I was not going to let a white person with some sort of idea of grandeur or something like that, which I suspect a lot of it is, to lead me down a path of death. And I was going to blindly follow that person into something that just wasn't going to happen. As far as I would say, I would do the best, that was not going to happen. So that's something to be cautious about if there's someone out there who is in a similar position. Thank you for listening.
Appreciate that. I know that definitely has come up many times down through the years where if you're a black person on the job and you have a suggestion, you have an idea that you think might work, might, you know, improve things on the job, and just being totally discarded worldwide. I can remember folks outside the states who called in with the exact same experience. They have an idea, they have an suggestion. Shut up, nigger. Or they totally ignore you or pretend that they're ignoring you, and then they will wait a week, sometimes 5 minutes, and then a white person will come and say the exact same thing, give the exact idea that you just gave, and it'll be, oh, outstanding, great, uh-huh, we'll implement that, uh-huh, give you a raise, a promotion, everything, and wait a minute, I just said, oh, shut up, nigga, get back over there, that's not right. It's standard uh-huh operating uh-huh procedure, so I'm sure tons of people, unfortunately, can relate to that, and that's just the system of white supremacy. I think even someone had said it was, I guess, a situation they were supposed to be training a white person on it, or it was, at minimum, it was a new white employee. And they were just, you know, trying to help them out and saying, hey, this is, you know, not the correct procedure. You're going to make an error if you do it this way. And they just kind of, whatever, get out of here. You don't know what I'm talking about. And they went and kept doing it, made the error. And then a white person had to come and tell them, you're doing it the wrong way. You need to do it this way. Said the same thing, basically, that a black person had just said. And so this happened in front of the black person. So the white person was like, oh, hmm. And he said, well, you know, everyone is entitled to make one error, implying that, you know, I'm perfect and I don't even make mistakes. This is just, you know, a minor aberration to my perfection as a white person. That's, as you said, these illusions of grandeur, standard operating procedure. I'm sure tons of folks can relate to that directly, indirectly.
Yeah, and a job like mine, like I said before, like the one I was on, you know, and some other jobs, you know, the company may lose some money or something like that. This case, you can lose your life behind some fool who it was not pay attention to anything that you have to say, and you have had the experience before, and because they are the quote unquote captain or lieutenant or whatever, that they would just disregard on what you're saying, and someone can get killed by it, you know. And so, yeah, that's something to really be a paying attention to on your job. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That reminded me, a retired firefighter, one of our listeners, she called in. She had a great suggestion for workplace racism, because I've said that I just do not believe we'll have 50 people call in and be on the phone. That's not even counting people listening online, just people listening on the phone. And then sometimes for workplace racism, it'll be totally silent where no one has anything to say. And I've said consistently and still say that is, I just do not believe that. I think for whatever reason, people don't want to share or ashamed. I know it's not the most proud thing to be talking about being roughed up on the job. And I've said, too, if you figured out some things that work well for you to kind of minimize some of this, that's, hey man, be on speed dial, because we need that. But it's really important to share, because I think you'll see a lot of patterns, and it can help, because the people, and I think the female caller I'm talking about, she mentioned a retired firefighter specifically, because she's younger than our retired firefighter, and saying that it's helpful to hear older black people and hearing some of their workplace experiences so that they can see, oh, okay, these are some of the things that happen, so I won't be stunned if this should happen to me, and I'll already be thinking about how I want to handle that type of situation if it should pop up for me on the job. So if you are listening, even if you don't have something right now, which I do not believe, but whatever, let's say you don't have, your white people are being all right with you on the job right now, not causing you any problems. Okay. If you can reflect on your total work experience, and if you can remember incidents when you were more confused, right? If you can remember where there were some problems and you didn't respond the correct way, or just it was not a good situation, and now that you have better information, you know you would respond differently. That would be good to hear too, because people have said that it is helpful to hear some of these workplace incidents and people's work histories, just so they get a better idea of the type of things that they can expect from racists on the job, and then also strategies they can be thinking in advance of how they would respond in that situation. So that can be another way if you are struggling with a way to participate or how to share in workplace racism. That's definitely one to kind of reflect on your own workplace history, workplace experiences, things that could have happened maybe even some years ago, and maybe you didn't do the correct thing. Maybe you didn't have all the information that you do now about racism. You can just share that, what you did then and what you would do now, being more informed. Other folks have commentary that you would like to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, was there a female just now? I still haven't heard a female.
I did. I can wait if you want to go.
You can go first if you like. I'll go after you. That's fine.
Okay, I'll be really quick. I just wanted to share my workplace racism. It's been about a month since I started a new position at a law firm. And so far, so much racism has taken place. It's just kind of amazing to me because it's been a while since I've really been in this environment, because I've tried to minimize my contact. But now that I'm really engulfed back in workplace, it's really just fascinating to see. So it's been a month. I've been promoted. Oh, wow. To a manager over a white girl who they are trying to force to quit because she's pregnant and she's not doing any work. And so what better way to try to force her to quit than to put her under the new girl, so to speak, who no one is helping. But they randomly on Friday promoted me to a manager over her. She has to report to me. And the receptionist, they just hired a black receptionist. So it should be interesting to see how this works out. Also, in this month that I've been there, a couple days ago, one of the attorneys, he quit. So they had a going away party for him. And I knew that. I said, okay, well, I just want to go to observe. And I knew it was going to be brief for me. But it was interesting because, just like you said, leading into workplace racism this evening, Gus, you know, of course, sobriety would be best. It just was fascinating to me how all these attorneys and quote-unquote so-called professionals, after work at 5 o'clock, there's a bar directly across the street from the law firm where I work. And everybody went over to the bar for this going-away party, and at I guess it was about 6:30. They all started getting sloppy drunk. I was, you know, kind of was like, well, I don't drink. I'm not interested. And I knew that I had to leave and I wasn't interested in hanging out. So I just noticed how they were ordering just liquor, and it was all, you know, put it on our attorney, the law firm's tab. And they were getting sloppy drunk. I mean, it was just absolutely just, I was just like, wow, okay, this is the norm for them. And so I, you know, excused myself, you know, said I'm leaving. But the very next day, I guess half of the office was late. They came in staggering in, hungover. When I was driving into the office, like I said, the bar is across the street from the firm. I noticed that, like, in Michigan, you can't smoke inside of the bars and restaurants here. So they have, like, a designated area for people to go outside and smoke. When I left, everything looked okay. But the next morning when I was driving past it, I noticed the windows were busted out of this, like, area. It was like ramshacked. I'm like, what happened? So when I got into the office, one of the head attorneys was saying, oh my goodness, we gotta, you know, call and apologize to the manager over at the restaurant, because, you know, we just really just got out of control. He was saying how he doesn't remember how he got home. He woke up in the same suit. that he was in yesterday. Now, mind you, I don't know how many people remember me sharing at the Christmas party. This is the same attorney that decided to give the black penis for the white elephant gift. And he was, you know, he got really drunk, and he's a managing attorney. So, again, I was just like, wow, I'm so glad I got out of there and just wasn't, you know, a part of that. And so they were just talking about the next day how they just got wild and out of control and how they have to, you know, pay for the damages that they caused at the place across the street. And I thought, okay, this is their culture. This is how they operate. Another thing that I find interesting at this law firm, there is always a super nosy white woman that just asks too many questions. So there's this one lady there. She is uncomfortable with the fact that I'm quiet. I don't talk. I go in. I do my work. I'm, you know, focused on assisting the callers, you know, the black people that I need to assist. And I just don't socialize with them. I try to minimize as best I can just talking to them. I'm very short. I'm friendly, but I don't get engaged in personal conversation. And so every morning she, oh, you're so quiet. You're so quiet. Oh, why are you so quiet? And she'll ask me questions, and she's, you know, uncomfortable, I guess, because she's not getting more out of me, whereas the other black people in the office, they're just, you know, trying to be liked. And so I noticed there's always that one person that is, you know, just super nosy. And so she is, I guess I'm her project to try to break me in. But, I, you know, I'm very observant of her. So that's the my month experience at the law firm. And then the other thing, I did want to get some feedback if I could. I do have a youth program that I run at one of the high schools. My daughter actually attends a high school that I have a public speaking and leadership program. And I think I've mentioned it before last year. It's interesting because I am very passionate about trying to get the black students involved in the program to help increase their public speaking skills, their leadership skills, just to increase their self-confidence and black self-respect. And I had I would say 90% to 100% black club. This is a predominantly white school, but I was successful at getting majority black students in the program. And last year we had one white student who showed up, and the entire, just the ambiance of the club changed. She didn't come back after maybe two sessions last year. But this year, I had the program again. This is the third year. And I noticed now the principal, there's a white principal at the school, and he's really pushing white students to participate. And he's been successful at getting white students to participate in my program because I do a lot of work with trying to get scholarship money for black students. And he saw that it was an all-black club. And now the white presence of just, I think there's like three white students that showed up. And I'm struggling with their presence because they're shy. They're not as aggressive as other white students would necessarily be in the school, but they just their presence alone is intimidating to the black students in the club. So I'm just trying to figure out how to navigate through that because I'm noticing the participation is dwindling off from the black students, whereas they were really comfortable when it was all black. There's three white students now just showed up. And it's different, and I notice it. So I don't know. I just want to see. Graham, it's been pretty interesting so far.
Wow. Let's see. Do we have folks, anybody who has feedback on how to handle that situation where you have white infiltrators that have changed the group dynamic and how to counter that?
Yes, I do. But I'll wait till everybody went through. I'll wait till everybody went through. I definitely have some suggestions.
To somebody else who had some feedback?
Hey, can I be heard?
I can hear you, Thomas. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, please.
Yes. Now, I remember this, the lady coming on telling this story a while back, and one person came and how the whole ambiance of the whole club changed. Are you allowed to control the curriculum that you do the public speaking and things about?
I have full control of the curriculum. It's an after-school program, and I have full control, yes.
So why don't you give them a whole bunch of black stuff to have to recite? You know, stuff that you know they ain't going to want to do. You know what I'm saying? Just to make it real uncomfortable for white people, make them very uncomfortable.
Good suggestion. And, you know, it's interesting that you say that because every year I have a speech contest at the end of the year, and I actually pick the topics for the competition. And last year I wanted to have as a topic like Black Lives Matter or something that was specifically about just black people. And I actually was, you know, in my mind, I guess, just chickened out. I was like, I don't want to cause any problems with my program because it's gained momentum. It's a predominantly white school. And I didn't go through with that. And it was an all-black club last year. And it's just interesting that you say that because I know that I played a part in not doing that last year. And then I came back this year with more support from the white principal. He's actually pushing more white students to get in the program. And now here I am, you know, like, okay, well, this is what I was trying to avoid, just this strong white presence, because I'm not doing this program to help white people. I'm doing the program to help black people because I know that the students in the school need it. White people don't have issue with self-esteem. So they don't have that issue with that, you know, public speaking, so to say, and self-confidence. It's the black students. And so I'm like sick to my stomach when, you know, more and more white students are showing up because I'm like, well, I can't do this because just inside of me, I'm not even at my best when I see the club is being infiltrated with white students. So I'm glad you suggested that because it just brings back the fact that I cowered out, I guess, at the opportunity to make that the subject.
If you do Black Lives Matter, do Why Black Lives Don't Matter. Give us a nice speech on Why Black Lives Don't Matter. Let them come out and recite that. So see them, let them go home to their parents and help them make that nice little speech up.
Good suggestion. Thank you.
I know a retired firefighter had some suggestions as well that I want to hear, because I think he shared about this in workplace racism too, where it wasn't white children, but white people come and infiltrate a predominantly black environment where they're trying to do constructive things with black children, and he had the same problem. But just building right on what Thomas in New York was saying in terms of make it really, really black content and even focused on racism, I'm a big fan of focusing on local history. You're in Michigan. Let's talk about Michigan history. I mean, they have infamous the Detroit Riot. In fact, you could even make a connection. We're going to learn about Michigan State history and how that relates to things that are happening right now. The Detroit water crisis, the Flint water crisis, the emergency management, all of that. And let's just look at some of the things that happened. You get Joe Louis and the arena and all that that played out right now, the riots that happened in the 1940s, and there's tons of content on that. We've done some of it on the program. But you could, because I'm sure some of this would tie directly to their families, where you could learn about how large numbers of black people ended up in Michigan, what was the white response, and then to see if any of their family members, to see if they have grandparents or great-grandparents or aunts, uncles, who say, oh, yeah, our, you know, uncle Joe, or your grandfather, your great-grandfather, they migrated here from Mississippi or Louisiana, and then you go and talk to them and see what they have to say. I think that might be a great one, and you can expose direct white terrorism because they're doing all this talk about rioting in Baltimore and rioting in Ferguson. Hey, white people threw down in Michigan and were going out and killing black people because they didn't want Negroes moving into their neighborhood. I'm a big fan. Let's just do state. Who can complain about us doing state history of Michigan? We're in Michigan. Why is that a problem? In school, we should be learning about this anyway, shouldn't we? I think that would go a long way to minimize white participation if we're focusing on white terrorism against black people and super black issues, just focusing on the history of racism in your particular state. I think that also might help reduce white people from wanting to participate. And just in my view, that's a clear act of white supremacy. We talk all the time about white people not being ignorant. The white principal sending all of these white students, in my view, anytime white people see black people trying to do something that's helping other black people, they go to sabotage that like immediately. They waste no time with all deliberate speed. Let's mess that up as soon as possible. What can we do? Mess it up. Just send five or six little white children. Think of those white teens in Arizona. Send them and mess it up. And even it reminded me of Dr. Welsing. She said she was doing the Welsing Institute over the years. White people would come. She said the exact same thing. It would be a room full of black people, and just one white person's presence would change the entire dynamic of the black people and how they were functioning in that environment. That's why I said we should call things by their correct name. It's not white privilege. That is white power, when it just takes one white person to totally change how black people are behaving, responding, even when it's tons of black people in the environment and just a single white person. That was my feedback.
Thank you.
This is the retired firefighter. I would first say that what you are doing is vitally important, because other than perhaps these children's parent or parents, they may not hear this valuable information that you have to share with them from anyone else. So it's vitally important. So I know you may feel a little bit uneasy. I think you've mentioned that. But go ahead on, and just like Gus and Mr. Thomas has been saying, put it out there. And Mr. Fuller shared with me something a long time ago that I'll never forget. He says, if you're uneasy about talking directly about racism, white supremacy, talk about justice. It ends up being the same thing, because when you really look at it, and this is the reason why this program exists, is the main enemy to justice is the system of racism, white supremacy. So all of it is one and the same. So, if you feel uneasy about talking about directly about race or voice, talk about justice to the kids. But with me, from my experiences of doing what you do, and I do it in the form of coaching football, high school football, and I've been doing it since 1981, and I'm at the point now to where I say out openly that my purpose of doing this is football is a vehicle for me specifically to share and exchange with non-white black males who need me the most, and I need them the most. And I let the chips fall where they may. Whoever got a problem with that, then they find they can entertain it with me and let me know on what's wrong with it as far as they're concerned. But no, stay focused on it. Talk about justice. Have them to come up with projects and ideas that will give some ideas towards the avenue towards directly how to get to the point to where justice is being practiced amongst people. And then automatically that would take care also the main problem that's in the way of that happening, which is the system of racism, white supremacy. I hope I was clear on how I was explaining it to you.
Very clear. Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate the feedback.
Let me know if you need any, if there's anything we can do to help out finding materials, because we have done quite a few programs on specific things in Detroit. I know the thing that sticks out in my mind during World War II, there were black people that were going to work in some of the factories to support the war.
Mm-hmm.
6,000 white women went on strike, mm-hmm, because they hired like 10 black females, and they were totally 6,000 white women went on. I mean, incredible things happened in the state of Michigan down through the years. That sort of information, and like I said, just tying that to the fam. Anything we can do to help out, let me know. I'd be glad to pitch in to find some resources and to just hear how all that evolves. I didn't want to let slide the workplace aspect of it, too. Just really quickly, you saying that the people on your new job, they want to get this pregnant white woman to see if they can get her quit. They don't just go out and fire her. They want to see if they can get her to quit. To put you as her manager, we will see if we can get her to quit by putting a black female as her manager and giving her a black receptionist to see if that will, you know, get her to her wits' end so she will go ahead out of the door voluntarily. That is another example, in my opinion, of white people not being ignorant about racism, white supremacy. They know how to use black people to upset other white people and to manipulate even other white people using racism to their advantage. And also the drunken debauchery that you observed, that standard operating procedure, and it even reminded me of our book club on Friday, Andrew Jackson's inauguration, where they did the same thing. It got so bad that he had to climb out of the window to escape the madness because it had gotten so out of control. This is presidential inauguration, 19th century. If other folks, Roz had a hand up and graciously allowed the black female to go first. I hope the caller that was working with Bernie Sanders' campaign is still with us, because I was very interested to hear his workplace racism. I'll definitely make overtime if you would like to share. But I did want Roz to go ahead. Thank you for being patient, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. And yes, I'm looking forward to that as well. That was something I was thinking about. This was like a white supremacy hell week for me. It was really interesting, the kind of things that happened. On Thursday, I actually take calls sometimes from people dealing with their health insurance accounts. I get this call from this white woman, and she like goes off on this tangent about Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act and how she's sick of having to pay for fat, overweight, unhealthy people, and this is some BS, and she's just going off. And then she actually tells me at the end of the call, vote for Donald Trump. You know, he's the best person to handle all the problems that the United States is facing. And she said it like three times before she hung up. And I just thought about that, and I said, wow, she's the average racist white supremacist I might stand next to on the train. And here I am getting a call from this person, and she's basically displaying her racism, not understanding she's speaking to and a black male on the other end of the phone. And it just brings me to the point that whenever I come into contact with black people in particular, I really go out of my way to assist them as far as navigating the healthcare industry, because I know that we're at a deep deficit as far as understanding how it works and just getting the best information to make great decisions. Also, I had another incident Thursday evening, riding home on the train. I was taking New Jersey Transit, and I was preparing to come into my stop in the train station. And there's a white female standing behind me, and I have shades that I wear when I'm on the train, and I can see like a mirror effect on the door because I'm facing the door to get off the train, and I see her like she's making a stupid grin, and she's shuffling behind me. So I'm turning around, and I looked at her like twice, and I just gave her a stone face each time. So then the third time I turn around, she says, oh, I'm sorry, your pocket's open. So I'm thinking to myself now, why couldn't you just tap me on the shoulder, say, sir, your pocket's open, and let me close it myself and call it a day? You're sneaking. You know, you're just doing it in a clandestine manner. She's surrounded by white males. None of them say a thing. They're just watching her do whatever she's doing with the stupid grin on her face. And I'm thinking to myself, Voltron effect, codification, protect the white broad behind me. And, I looked at her. I just said, thank you. But I said it in a plain stone-faced tone with no smile whatsoever, and immediately started searching, looking for the pocket that she was fiddling with. And because the train was pulling into the station, immediately upon getting off the train, I checked the pocket to make sure she didn't steal anything, because at that point, black self-respect mode was going to kick in and she was going to see me, and it was not going to be pleasant. So she didn't steal anything, and then I just kept walking, and it just gave me a pause for thought. What if the shoe was reversed, and she was the one with the pocket open on her backpack, and I'm surrounded by white men, and I just go to choose with a stupid grin on my face to clandestinely close her pocket, the pocket. Would they have not cleaned my clock on that train and said I was trying to steal from her? And I was really pissed off, and I let her know just by giving her the stone face. And then finally, on Wednesday evening, I was coming home from work, and we're all in
New York Penn Station on 34th Street, and the train is coming into the station, so there's a massive run for the staircase. So as we're going, there's this guy, big white guy, looked like Lurch from the Munsters. He's about 6'3", fat, overweight, and he's basically shoving his way through the crowd, and I happen to be standing next to him. And weirdly enough, I was listening to the cows. I was listening to Dr. Wells, and I've been going through each of the episodes in succession, and it's been a world of information. So I'm listening to the cows, and this white man does this, and he's shoving through the crowd. So I stop, and I literally scream in his face. I tell him, you know, you need to wait and back off. You're not going to push me out of the way to get wherever you have to go, because I'm not having it today. And then I looked at him, and I just stopped walking, and I looked at him. Now, we're surrounded by all kinds of people rushing for the train, and he turns beet red. And I was waiting for him to either say something funny or to try something slick. But he literally looked – there was a look of fear in his face, and he just backed down, shut up, and then kept on walking. And then I gave him a second glance just before I hit the staircase, and then I looked back because I don't trust him. So I looked back again before I got on the train, and I was just so fed up at that point. But immediately, I don't tolerate nonsense from white people. So the moment he basically did what he was doing, I immediately checked it. I was not going to stand for it in any way. And obviously, that's the way that ended up. It could have gone a different way, but obviously, there was nothing to him. And the other thing I was going to say was that I noticed that my company, it's a health insurance company, when I was assisting one of the members, that they have a list of LGBTQ friendly physicians that we can offer to people who the whole anti-sexual community gets this special treatment of this database in which we can search, and it'll tell us if doctors are LGBTQ friendly, and the ones that aren't labeled as such, so they know to avoid them. And I thought about it, you know, the healthcare issues that black people go through, they should actually have a list of physicians that are friendly to black people. And I thought about I was thinking about bringing the book Killing the Black Body or Medical Apartheid in to kind of facilitate that. But I thought about it. I said, that'll be the first day of my demise. But what I do on a personal level on the job is to help black people that I come across as much as possible to get the best care possible. And the white folks, it is what it is. I do it. I have to do it in the scope of my job. Keep it short and keep it moving. But those are my workplace racism stories. Thanks for listening.
Week of terrorism. Wow. I don't live in New York, but I do know, just paying attention to the news, I've seen a lot of incidents that go down on the subway there, the train, whatever. Even I think a more recent one, it was a white woman where she was on and terrorizing. It was that same thing. She was by herself, one white woman, group of black people, and she went terrorized all of these black people, even physically assaulted one black male. She hit him repeatedly and total terrorist. And the police were not called. Transit authority. I know they have transit NY police that work the train station and all that stuff to try to keep order. So they say nothing. She doesn't get arrested. Nobody hops out to choke her out and all that stuff. She just gets to terrorize all these people and then go on her merry way. And we've had other people who've called in before who talked about these sort of incidents that happen where folks, you know, on the train in transit to work and what have you. Just say again, be on alert. This is total war. You just cannot afford to slip on your guard or to not be paying attention. People even commented about having headphones on, that might not be the best idea because you can't really hear things that are happening around you, so you're missing information. You really have got to be paying total attention, have constant vigilance, because you never know when an incident can happen and you might have to respond to a white terrorist that's in your immediate environment, and I mean like within the next 5 minutes. So really be alert. And just be aware. I know that's a terrible way to have to function, but that's the environment that we live in. And I've seen too many illustrations where folks are not thinking that way. They're not paying attention. They're not cautious. And then, bam, it goes down. And within five, I think we've done whole programs on that. Within 5 minutes, whites can ruin your whole life. And you're just like, wow, I cannot believe that this happened so quickly. So be alert. Be aware, particularly in those type of environments where you're in close proximity to white strangers at that. You don't even know who these folks are. Our caller, I think I said he was still with us, the caller who said he wanted to share for workplace racism, and you are a paid intern with Bernie Sanders' campaign. If you wanted to share for workplace racism, that would be a grand way to conclude things. Feel free to share, sir.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just
just a quick small issue. I mean, the racism that we face, I guess it's about 2 black guys out of 200, a staff of 200 right now. We were just recently in Birmingham for the Martin Luther King ritual. I mean, the Martin Luther King, Bernie Sanders was in Birmingham. You know, we went to go see the different sites like the church and stuff like that. But one staff member that's, I guess she's more experienced. She's over all of us, supervisor. I mean, and she just hands down all her tasks to me, to only me and the other black guy, you know, out of everybody. I mean, the other guy, he's from more of the country in Baymanet, and, you know, he just runs with it gleefully, happily, you know what I'm saying, the road calls, and once we're on the bus, the Bernie bus, and we go around the city, he just happily does everything, you know, and I had my training, you know, from Gus and listening to the show over the past couple months. Now, I'm a little bit more hesitant, but, yeah, she just hands down all her responsibilities and everything she's supposed to do down to us. And she just, you know, just runs away and has her own thing going on. I mean, I'm a big component of Bernie Sanders and you know, things are it's slightly remotely to white supremacy and a little bit of things he say. But just the experience on the road, you know, on the campaign, man. I mean, his followers, man, they damn near basically borderline racist as far as how they treat black people. You know, besides the funny looks and everything else, it's like we treat it as an outcast or, you know what I'm saying, like not a part of them. They don't talk to us that much. And, that's it. But, I mean, I can't really explain it. But, yeah. I mean, the workloads and everything they asked us to do, like I said, we was in Birmingham a couple nights back for the Martin Luther King reunion. And once getting the food and getting everything started, just, man, I mean, just the vibe, man, the funny looks and just, and, you know, the staff members, you know, it's kind of hard to explain. But, I mean, you can just sense something there. It's just complicated, but I mean that's basically it. You know, I didn't have nothing else, but that it just it, I mean that it's just pitiful, man. Looking at it, how it is, and it's such a subtle racism, and I don't know, Gus, man. It's hard to explain, but. You know, I've been on the road with DP for a couple of weeks, and the way they conduct themselves around black people, it's almost like we the predators, like we want white women or something, you know, and I guess that's it. I ain't really have too much.
Wow. Do you talk to, because you said this white woman, suspected white supremacist, that I guess is your direct manager or supervisor, that you feel like she's disproportionately given a lot of the tasks to you and this other black male. Do you and this other black male, do you all kind of talk about your observations and kind of what you're seeing, what you're experiencing from these white people where you're thinking, wow, they're looking at us like we're predators or we're trying to get white women? Or do you all have any conversations about that?
Yeah, I mean, I tried, but I don't like forcing myself on to anybody. But
right.
It's basically like her entire workload is like, you know, like she's confronted with a objection, and she just immediately, okay, where's the 2 black guys that I can, you know, hand this workload on to, and then that's it, and then she run away, and you know, we got to do it. But like I said, you know what I'm saying, I like Bernie Sanders and the things he talk about. But, like, because in Birmingham, I was with Cornel West, another senator, a black senator. I forgot her name, Crystal something, and all of them, you know. And you know, we on the campaign and we gonna let the black folks, you know, take control and get black votes and perform for us. Like you know what I'm saying? I don't wanna bring up Donald Trump, but just like how he you know, the choir comes out and then the speakers come out, Cornel West, everybody come out, and then just black folks just running, working around the clock. I mean, it just seems crazy. It's hard to explain. You know, like I said, roll call and then other stuff, going out to get food, this and that. You know, it's just immediately, like, you know, like I said, we the only few blacks out of hundreds or even maybe thousands of white folks, and we're doing everything, you know?
Is it? I'm just trying to see if I'm accurately grasping what you've been seeing for the time that you've been doing this. It seems like one level of the white supremacy is just working you all to death. You all are going to be our enslaved black folks. So we, you know, anything that's got to come up, you go do it. You go do it. You go do it. You said D, right? You said that was your name.
Yeah.
Okay. D, you and this other black male, you go do it. Boom, boom, boom. It's got to be roll calls or anything else. Got to go get food or whatever. Our other little run.
Exactly.
Spade work. That's my new word for 2016. Spade work that's got to be done. We'll go get you all and you do that. And then it seems like almost another level of the white supremacy is you all are in Alabama. It's a significant, sizable population of black people there and a long legacy. Y'all just said the 63 church bombing and the Rosa Parks, the Montgomery bus boycott, long history, the Scottsboro case of having lots of black people look like they're associated with Bernie Sanders, whether it's you all paid interns. You said Dr. West was there. It was a black female politician that you said was there. So given the appearance that there are lots of black people that are associated with Bernie Sanders' campaign, so if black people are seeing this, like, oh, wow, okay, Bernie Sanders is for black people. He's got black people working with him, and Dr. West is here. Some black people that I recognize, like, oh, okay, so this will appeal.
Yeah,
black-
he's supposed to be on our side. He's supposed to be on our side, and it's like all we hear is Martin Luther King, not black, so do this and that. And that's it. And I was just wondering, you know, your input, because, I mean, he's talking about a whole bunch of stuff that blacks need, like as far as job opportunities, et cetera. You know, he's talking about the prison, the private prison industrial system. But his entire campaign is like blacks running around doing stuff and helping them out and talking and propping them up, you know, to a whole nother level. Yeah, and it's confusing, man. I mean, I had to take a break from it because, it was just getting pretty intense. You know, I got sick, I got a fever, you know, I'm at home now. But, I mean, I guess it's all good. Probably
just
thinking about it too hard or whatever.
It's definitely my opinion. It is not all good. The system of white supremacy. I'm trying to stop saying that myself because for me at least, it is not all good as long as we're under white supremacy. But my encouragement would be if you continue to do this. You said this is a paid intern, so this is like a job situation at least on a temporary basis. My suggestion would be, I say this to everybody, I say it on pretty much a weekly basis, in terms of having a workplace journal so that you can kind of write down some of these observations. I tell people that all the time. It's important for a myriad of reasons because, number one, our memory is not as good as we think, so a lot of times we'll forget small details and things that happen. It sounds like you all are moving around. You're on the bus and doing this and doing that. Got 1,000 things going on, so you will forget things. That's one. And then two, just in terms of being able to process, you said yourself, just trying to make sense of what is happening, where this Bernie Sanders is saying these things that sound like they would be good for black people, and Dr. Cornel West is saying he's carrying on the tradition of Fannie Lou Hamer and Dr. King and all of this. So it sounded like, hey, he's saying he wants to what they call revamp the prison system and change that all around, and he wants to have free tuition and all these things that seemingly would be good for black people, and like he's supporting black people, but then you're looking at the way you're being treated by his white staff members, his white employees, and it seems like these folks are racist, and the way that they're delegating work responsibilities, the way that they're treating you, the way that they're looking at you, it seems like they're functioning like these folks are racists. I think it would help you to process that, just writing down, and this doesn't have to be like, you know, 20 pages, 50 pages. You could just write, take 5-10 minutes and just write your thoughts down on a regular basis as you see things, and then you can reflect back over it. I think that will help you a lot to process that. You'll have a better understanding of things that are happening. I'm sure there's a lot of folks listening would be interested in hearing. I think Bernie Sanders, I suspect that he is a white supremacist. You have white people that are very good at talking and giving a lot of rhetoric that they care about black people, particularly when it's election season and it's, oh, we need to get a few Negroes to come out and vote for us and what have you. And then they just go back to standard operating procedure and maintaining white supremacy. But I think it would be very informative. If you stick with this, I know, you know, I don't know what your plans are, but if you stick with this for a while, I think it might be very informative to a lot of our listeners just to hear more detail about your experience. And like I said, just notes so that you can have a lot of detail about what's happening on a day-to-day basis. Is this widespread? Are other people that are interns that are working on the staff, are they having a similar experience with how they're being treated? If you even bring up any of these issues about the delegation of work responsibilities, how is that handled? Not even bringing up racism, just in terms of how the work is being allocated. It seems like me and this other black guy are getting a lot of work. Is this correct? Are we supposed to be delegating responsibilities evenly amongst the interns that are working here? And just see how they respond. But I think that would be extremely informative for a lot of our listeners, just to have a little bit more clarity about the love train that is supposed to be Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I mean, just listening to the show, man, is just open my eyes up to a whole bunch of stuff, because you should see the other guy. Like, it's real sad, like, how happy he is to receive these orders. You know, he doesn't even supposed to be here for this, and, you know, he's just running around, and, you know, I think his name, Mark, you know, he's a big guy, and he's, I mean, like, they just hand him a sheet of paper, and he does everything, and then, you know, he passed the load on to me, and we're the only two black guys, and everybody else just sitting around comfortably, and, you know, we just run around, just, you know, it's just crazy, man. But, I keep you guys in tune and what goes on. Like I said, Bernie Sanders is probably the only person that's talking remotely, you know, the objectives that blacks want to achieve. But, I mean, still experiencing racism, man, I mean, to that level. Like, okay, we're just going to get the blacks to do whatever we need to do, and we're going to win. That's it. excuse me. I don't think that's right at all. But, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, man.
Fascinating. Definitely. If you keep us informed, I personally would definitely appreciate it. If you want to share on workplace racism, or if you want to give us updates as you continue with the work, I think it would be super helpful just for clarity for our listeners. And again, I submit whites are very good at this sort of thing, where they give a lot of rhetoric that this is change. I'm not racist. I'm white, but I understand your plight, black people, and I'm going to do things to help you out. But it somehow ends up looking like the same old plantation that we've always had, invariably. I've seen that play out repeatedly. We did way over time. Did anybody have one question that they wanted to get in for D and his commentary on what's going down being a paid intern with the Bernie Sanders campaign? One person they wanted a question or comment they wanted to get in real quick.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. You did kind of just.
Yes.
See if somebody else.
Oh, okay. Okay.
If nobody else does, then Raj, you can take it away. But anybody else? Nobody else. I'm gonna let Raj get the last one in. Right on, Raj. Take it away.
Yes, I was just going to say, as he was discussing how they were looking at him, I just actually thought of Oda Benga, the South African that was placed on display in the Bronx Zoo. And also, I thought the reason that they would hand all of that work over to him and the other black male is for an easy scapegoat. So if something goes wrong, of course, they'll easily blame the black person, and then they can usher them up out of there. So I really thought, okay, this is the path of least resistance. So if I make a mistake or I drop the ball somewhere, I can just pass the buck on to them. So just be careful of what's going on and stay aware of your surroundings and what she's delegating to you, and keep a track of those things so that way you can protect yourself in case she tries to set you up in some way. And that was all I wanted to say. I wish you the best. And, yeah, I would love to hear more about this as things develop. Thanks again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think it's that. I think it's that they're just being lazy and just being preoccupied with their own lives and expecting that me as a big man and the other guys don't have our own lives. And, you know, we got stuff going on. And, you know, this and that, emails and, you know, blah, 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 a whole bunch of stuff. But... Yeah, definitely. I'd be more than happy to keep you guys posted on what's going on with the Bernie Sanders campaign. Things gonna shift and get a lot more hectic, being that we're leading in the polls.
Right.
But yeah, absolutely.
Right on. That with Ross's comment, I think that's important too, because I agree that the racist aspect of it, in terms of them just wanting to give all the work to the black people, that's standard. Whites do that sort of thing all the time. But I have seen too where they deliberately give the black employees like 2 and 3, 4 times the amount of work that they're supposed to have, where they're really doing like 5 people's jobs. And then invariably when the black person makes an error, it's, oh my gosh, now we got to hold you accountable. I've seen where that happens a lot too. We're down the road where you just worn this person out and they just can't do it anymore. They mess up on a deadline, didn't do it exactly the way that it was specified to be done. And then that becomes, we got to take punitive action and that sort of thing too. So I think it's always good to be mindful of that. And the metaphor, I thought it was almost apropos there. Pass the buck. Whites are very good at passing it off on bucks. They are have been known for calling black people that down through the years, and even shooting bucks. I think they call the animals that they go out and shoot when it's hunting season bucks as well. I think that's no coincidence. No coincidence it is under the system of white supremacy. But definitely, if you want to keep us updated, that would be grand. I'm sure other folks will have questions or just interest hearing this in the archives and what have you, and want to keep up to date and might even have some questions down the road. Definitely, we did our overtime this evening. I hope it was constructive for folks listening in. If you have questions, gripes, complaints, contributions you want to share, feel free. You can drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll be back. Let's see. Pam will be here on Wednesday. Trojan Horse Publications. She'll be here on Wednesday. She wanted an opportunity to share some of her thoughts on the passing of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. As I said earlier, I know, lots of us are still going through the grieving process, trying to process the loss of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. But Pam will be here on Wednesday. We'll probably talk about some other things as well. But that's Wednesday, normal broadcast time. Thursday, I have to post the article. That's why I say you should read the paper, local, national, global. I make an effort because I think I read the New York Times more than I read the Seattle Times, and that's probably incorrect since I'm thousands of miles away from New York. But the Seattle Times, they had an article latter part of 2015. I think it was December, we'll say. And it was a white woman. She's a professor at the University of Washington, and she was talking about her ancestors were enslavers, white enslavers in this area of the world, and how that benefited her family, even trickling down and benefiting her, and being honest about that, and saying that she is a white person, that she wanted to be honest about that, she wanted to speak out about that, about how that's impacted her in the position that she's in, being a pretty lofty professor, I might add, probably extremely well paid at a public university. She's willing to come on the program. She should be here this coming Thursday. Thursday, normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Now, this cagey racist suspect said she did not want to take questions from listeners. Now, she asked lots and lots of questions I did not send her the website. I sent her a brief audio snippet. One of our more recent programs, we had a white person on. She listened to that. I didn't say the name of the program in the clip that I sent her, but she said she didn't want to take just random questions from people about her enslaver white family members. So if you check out the article, I'll post it so people can, you know, see, and you can do any research that you'd like prior to Thursday. And then if you want to write your questions in or things that you think it would be good to ask her, if you submit them like that Wednesday or early Thursday, even that would work. Then I can just ask him as we roll for the program. But she said she didn't want to take any questions, and that was the only way I could finagle it to get her on the program. But I am excited to have yet another white person on the program. This, I think, will be our third white woman in a week's time. So it will be good to see if we can observe some patterns in the way that these white women in particular have presented about racism, and particularly since they're talking about their white racist family members. But that'll be Thursday. For the folks who've been following the book study session on The Half Has Never Been Told, all of that should be kept in mind as we're talking about earlier stages of white supremacy, slavery, this area of the world. Keep that in mind, the way that she talks and presents about what her pillaging terrorist ancestors did to our black family members. But that should be Thursday. We might have some programs that pop up earlier in the week before we get to Wednesday, but definitely Wednesday, Thursday, we should be here. If you can't find something in the archives, you get confused, you have gripes, just drop an email and we'll try and answer your question as best I can. Suggestions, all that stuff, just let me know, untiljustice@gmail.com. Again, for the folks that are on the East Coast, remain safe, remain warm. I'm so glad I'm not out there. But for the folks who are there, Joe in D.C., I know you were saying how tough it was, and Roz, Thomas in New York. Man, I hope you don't have to go out too much. If you do, be as safe as you possibly can. Stay warm. I hope you have lots of supplies and groceries inside so you're not, you know, caught in a dangerous situation without resources. And hopefully the weather will warm up a bit and melt so that you all won't have to deal with all of that 6 feet of snowdrift and all that other just madness. As Dr. Welsing said, the real white supremacy on display in the Northeast right now. With that, thanks everyone for tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. I'll say again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. If you are going to be out and about, you do not want to be in the presence of intoxicated whites. You heard from our caller in Michigan, can end up in property damage, police being called, anything can go down. Extremely dangerous environment that should be avoided. I would even discourage being in the presence of intoxicated non-white people. It's just a situation rife with bad decision-making, and we already got enough problems as victims of racism. If you're going to be behind the wheel, if you're going to be a pedestrian or a passenger, you do not want to be under the influence. You never know when you're going to bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any of these other race soldiers. You want to be lucid, clear thinking, so that you can make the best possible decision to protect yourself and any non-white people that you might be responsible for. That being said, we're fundraising 2016. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop me an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us, help us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. In the words of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, it is an exercise in black self-respect to refrain from name-calling and squabbling with other black people. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.